Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com. Bridgewater State University is proud to sponsor this conversation from Boston Public Radio. More at bridgew.edu/gradclass.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we are back, and we're back at the Boston Public Library. Today is primary election day here in the Commonwealth, and we're continuing our long tradition with virtually every statewide candidate phoning in with a last-minute pitch to you. That will include the Democratic candidates for Attorney General, the two Republican candidates for Governor of the Commonwealth, and all the rest.
Then it's the newly married Trenny Casey, nay, Trenny Kuznarek, from NBC Sports Boston. We've heard plenty about the newly formed LIV golf tour and its financial ties to Saudi Arabia. Now that the tour is up and running, tension has turned to the spectacle. Our DJs, beer, fireworks, the future of golf, and tennis star Serena Williams makes her swan song showing at this year's U.S. Open. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Broadcasting live at the Boston Public Library, as we do every Tuesday and Friday. I know you got a great tan, Jim, on your vacation.
That's funny. By the way, you say every Tuesday and Friday. We haven't been here in like 6 months. I don't know what you're talking about. I hope this is not like riding a bicycle. I hope it is like riding a bicycle.
It's like riding a bicycle.
Now, by the way, the listeners apparently have forgotten us, too. I look at the first text we get, and this woman, Marianne Wareham, says, I voted last Tuesday, but was regretting it as I've learned more about some of the candidates. Then she texts again, oops, wrong show. Well, this is close enough. So here's the deal. Henry Santora pretty much laid it out. For the couple of decades plus that Marjorie and I have been on the radio, we have a tradition every election day, primary election day and final election day. We invite every single statewide candidate, and if they're congressional races, those two, who is in a contested primary to join us. So as a result, make a final pitch that will be the candidates for Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, Auditor, Secretary of State. And their final pitch is not a traditional interview like we do if we had a usual 25 minutes, just an opportunity for them to make a final pitch. For example, Maura Healey will not be here today because obviously she is uncontested in the primary, Democratic primary for governor, even though I believe Chang Diaz is still on the ballot. So that's how it works. Brief, 5 minutes each for each of the candidates. In this first segment, in a minute, we're going to talk to the two Republicans running for governor, Chris Doty and Jeff Deal. We'll then talk a few minutes after that to Shannon Liss Reardon, one of the two Democrats running for attorney general, then Diana DeSaglio, Democrat running for auditor. But joining us first, I believe, he is with us. Is that correct? Is one of the two candidates for auditor on the Democratic ticket. That would be Chris Dempsey. Chris, are you there, Chris? Well, we're off to a hell of a start. Okay.
Oh,
how have you been? How was your vacation?
I've been very well. I feel very sorry for myself. Vacation is over until Thanksgiving, I guess. But Chris Dempsey, of course, first gained notoriety, Jim, as our transportation nerd right here on Boston.
Well, actually, he ran the campaign with two friends against the Olympics in 2024.
Well, what are you talking about? He reached the big time when he came on with us talking about transportation issues. But he was a big opponent of the 2024
Olympics
right here in Boston, which we did not have right here in Boston.
By the way, you know, one of the things, while we're waiting for Chris, and it's our fault, not his, by the way, we didn't realize he's scheduled at 11:10. I thought he was scheduled right at the top of the show. You know, a couple of days ago, the incumbent Secretary of State, who's being challenged, obviously, Bill Galvin, said he expected turnout to be 23%. He's up that number a little, but even if it's in the high 20%, we have really strong candidates in every single primary. It's disgraceful. What are 75% of the people saying to themselves? It doesn't matter. There's no difference between Jane Doe and John Doe. I mean, it's really abysmal, don't you think?
Yeah, and some of the races are really close. I mean, Chris Dempsey, we're going to talk to him in a couple of minutes. His races really close for
with Diana DeSaglio.
And I don't know.
Attorney General race, supposedly neck and neck
very,
as well.
Very close as well. So it really matters. And, you know, we have races we're not going to talk about because we're just doing the statewide races. But this has been a real crazy race for Suffolk County District Attorney, you know, on both sides with allegations against Arroyo and with allegations against Hayden as well of different natures. But it's been kind of a wild ride for them, too. So I don't know. These are big deal races. And we're going to talk later today with Carol Rose from the ACLU, whose campaign, not hers, but the ACLU's in general, about what a difference a DA makes. I mean, a district attorney makes a huge difference in the district where you're from, whether that's a person that is more of the Rachel Rollins type, that is more into reforming the system, or whether they're a hardliner, which is something totally different. So these races do matter.
By the way, I read a text a minute ago. We have another text from Louisa. This is, oh, pardon me, this is a posting on YouTube. Missed you both. Whoops, wrong show. Okay.
Thank you.
In any case, joining us now is one of the two Democrats running for the nomination for auditor of the Commonwealth. That would be Chris Dempsey. Chris, welcome.
Jim and Marjorie, it's great to be back with you.
Great to have you.
I know. As I just said, you were a transportation nerd for quite some time, and you did a fine job, Chris Dempsey. So what are you doing today? What's your schedule?
We are all over the state today. I just got a text from a volunteer who's out in Royalston, Massachusetts, and North Central Mass with a homemade Dempsey for Auditor sign. I'm personally going to be in Boston, Newton, Cambridge, Brookline, all over the region. And look, we're fighting for every single vote through 8 p.m. It's been a remarkable experience to be on the campaign for the last 15 months, and it all comes down to the next 9 hours.
You know, Chris, we were talking right before you got on the line about the projections for turnout, which go from abysmal to almost abysmal. What do you make of that when there's so many races with so many, I think, talented people?
You know, look, it's tough on a rainy day, and I know that some people are probably listening to this right now and wondering whether they should get out to vote or not. I'm going to ask every single person that can hear my voice right now to get out to the polls if they haven't voted already. We are deciding the future of the Commonwealth today, who our next leaders will be, and this is a year of generational change. If I'm elected, I'll be the first millennial ever elected to statewide office in Massachusetts. We have great candidates up and down the ballot in the Democratic Party. Now, lots of great conversations over the last year about what we need in our Commonwealth, what needs to be fixed, how we're going to address the problems that people are facing. Today is the day for people to make that decision, and I really do urge everyone to be out there.
Why should whose auditor matter to people? I'm guessing most people have no idea what the auditor does, even though they've heard that maybe the current auditor is going to decide how much money could possibly be returned to taxpayers under the 1986 tax cap. Why should they care about the auditor's job in general?
This is an absolutely critical accountability and watchdog role. We've been served very well for the last 12 years by Auditor Suzanne Bump, the first woman to ever hold the office. She's the person who knows the job the best, and she's endorsed me to succeed her in this race. This is a role where you have to roll up your sleeves, dig into the details of state government to figure out what's working and what's not working and how things need to change. I'm the only candidate in this race with experience working in the executive branch. I was Assistant Secretary of Transportation for Governor Deval Patrick. And as you know, Jim and Marjorie, I've also stood up to protect taxpayers as the co-founder of the grassroots group No Boston Olympics. So I've proven I can do the work inside of government. I've proven I can work outside of government to stand up to protect taxpayers, and I want to do more of that work serving people as the next state auditor.
Wait a second. The Olympics is not coming here in 2024?
Not.
We're talking to Chris Dempsey, candidate for auditor.
So, Chris, we've got a little less than 2 minutes left. So tell us, give us your pitch and give us the major difference between you and your opponent, Diana DeSaglio.
Jim and Marjorie, I'm the son of public school teachers, and I saw through their career my parents digging into their own pockets to pay for school supplies for their students, as we know public school teachers do to this day across the Commonwealth. And that's not right. And it's the result of choices that we make on Beacon Hill and those dollars not flowing to the places where they can do the greatest good, public education, public transportation, public health. I'm fighting to make sure that every single dollar we have goes to those places that need it. And I've got a proven track record to do that. It's because of that track record that I'm supported by Mayor Michelle Wu, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. I've been endorsed by the Boston Globe, by 25 women legislators, including Senate President Karen Spilka, and by hundreds of local leaders across the state. I'm fighting for a more fair, a more equitable Commonwealth, and we've had an absolute joy and pleasure of doing this for the last 15 months. So excited by the support we've seen, with more to come.
Chris Dempsey, we wish you luck. I hope to talk to you in the future. Be well. Good luck today.
Thanks so much for having me on. And no matter who you're voting for today, please go out and vote.
You know, Thank you very much, Chris.
I just want to echo what Chris Dempsey said at the end. Go out and vote. If we end up with like a 26% turnout, we should be ashamed of ourselves. Ashamed? I don't get it. Maybe tomorrow or the next day we'll talk about what we do every couple of years about how to increase voter turnout, but hopefully people will take it seriously today. Speaking of taking it seriously, one of the candidates taking it very seriously on the Republican side, who hopes to oppose Maura Healey, who's unopposed on the Democratic side, is Chris Doty. Chris, good to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Jim and Marjorie, it's so good to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much for being with us, Chris Doty. So here is the crucial question, I think, for you, candidate Doty. If you had a choice, would you rather be endorsed by Donald Trump, like your opponent Jeff Deal, or would you rather be endorsed by Boston Herald columnist Howie Carr? And you are his man, I understand. So what do you think?
You know, I want to be endorsed by every citizen of Massachusetts. I would say that I'm much more interested in what happens in Worcester than Washington. So my heart and soul is here on Massachusetts and what I can do for our citizens here.
What's it been like? You know, you're a first-time candidate, obviously. I assume people know. I hope they know. What's been the greatest takeaway for you, Chris Doty, from this first ever statewide run?
You know, I arrived here in 1987, and I fell in love with Massachusetts. The people, the culture, the diversity, the geography. And this campaign, I have fallen back in love with Massachusetts. You know, being a candidate, I've studied the commerce, businesses coming and going. I've studied education, visited with many schools, the chambers of commerce, councils on aging. I've met probably hundreds of state employees. I've looked at policy, read legislation, and I've just fallen in love with our state all over again. We live in such a wonderful place, and I just, it's been a remarkable experience to be a candidate here and to sort of peel back what makes Massachusetts special and how do we compete with other states. It's a competitive organization. You know, we have Connecticut and New Hampshire, Tennessee, Virginia that we're competing with. And trying to figure out in my own mind, how will I compete or how would we compete with these other states so that our citizens prosper, has been a wonderful experience for me.
We're talking with Chris Doty. He, of course, is running against Jeff Deal for the governor of Massachusetts on the Republican side. So tell us why you are a better choice for the Commonwealth than Jeff Deal.
You know, Jeff wouldn't do any debates, so I'm sorry for everyone. They didn't get a chance to see us up on the stage. We had multiple invitations for televised debates, including yours. Thank you. I never would have had a chance. But if I had a chance to debate, I would have highlighted three things. Number one is that I've been a job creator. I've run a large business that started as a small business. I'm comfortable with budgets and problem solving and bring people together. I have executive level experience for three decades, and my opponent has no experience. He's probably qualified for other jobs in state government, but just certainly not running something as big and complicated as our state government. That's one. Number two is he's lost his last three elections by a landslide against Elizabeth Warren. He lost by 37 points in his own home state Senate race. He lost by 17 points, including his own hometown. And so he just doesn't have a pathway to beat someone like Maura Healey. The third one is his record. If I had a chance to debate him, I would have called him out on saying one thing and doing another. And let me just give a couple examples. One is he ran as a candidate for state rep and said that he was for lower taxes. But yet in the state house, he voted not only for higher taxes, but he even proposed a brand new tax in our state. Then he ran in as a state rep and said that he was for a smaller state government, a smaller budget, lower taxes. But every single year, he was in the state legislature, he voted for higher spending than the governor, both Governor Patrick and Governor Baker. And lastly, he runs on a campaign that he is for small businesses. But yet when he was in the state legislature, when there was a proposal to increase the requirements for unemployment, which would have driven down the cost of our high cost of unemployment insurance, he voted against it. And I was a business owner. And, you know, so he says one thing and does another, and I wish I had a debate to really highlight that he's kind of a failed career politician that says one thing and does another.
Well, you did, I mean, in this, just to have the record accurate, you did have one debate on Howie Carr's show on RKO. That is correct, correct?
That is correct. We had one debate, not televised.
Fair enough. Chris Doty, before you go, you have agreed, if you were the winner in the primary, to join us tomorrow. We wish you luck, and if that were to happen, we look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Chris, thanks so much for your time. Good luck today.
Well, thank you, and everyone go out and vote.
Well, we hope they do. Joining us now is another guy who's running for the Republican nomination for governor, who has also agreed to join us tomorrow. If he is the winner of his primary, that'd be former state rep Jeff Diehl. Jeff Diehl, good to talk to you.
Hey, Jim, how you doing? Is Marjorie there?
Hey, she is
indeed. I certainly am. Thanks for joining us, Jeff. Appreciate it. So I'm going to
thank you.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your opponent. You know, which is more important, Jeff Diehl, to get the endorsement of former President Donald Trump or to get the endorsement of legendary Boston Herald columnist Howie Carr, who used to be with you and he changed his mind? So what matters more?
Look, in the Republican primary, I'm very happy to have the endorsement of the president. And look, it's something that I obviously supported him in 2016. He knows that we share the same vision of trying to put people first. And he gave us 4 years of what I thought was a great economy, better foreign policy than we've got right now. And my goal for Massachusetts is to do what I was doing in the legislature, which is working for the people of the state, even if it cost me committee positions by my own Republican leadership. You know, I led the repeal of the index gas tax in Massachusetts. It was for the folks who just really were having trouble, you know, affording Massachusetts to begin with. We lost 50,000 people out of our state last year because of affordability. We've got to make housing more affordable. We need better transportation solutions. I've got that experience on Beacon Hill, and I'm a small business owner that understands what it's like to invest your life savings and try to grow a business in Massachusetts.
You know, Jeff Diehl, you covered a bit of what we're about to broach, which is what are the primary differences between you and your Republican opponent, Chris Doty? What's to recommend you over Doty?
Well, in a Republican primary, I know maybe your listenership doesn't agree with this, but he voted for Hillary Clinton. That, to me, seems like a disqualifier, but I guess he's got to cross that bridge with the voters, so we'll see where that goes. But ultimately, again, I have that hybrid experience. My wife and I have a 20-year-old business, plus I worked as a manufacturing representative. I still do right now. Mm-hmm. You know, he tries to say I'm a career politician. It's so funny. I was in the legislature for 8 years. I was 40 years old when I ran for office for the first time. Hell of a career in politics, right? But anyway, I'll leave that aside. Fact of the matter is I'm excited about the chance to go back to Beacon Hill in the corner office, work with legislators that I've known from the past that are very reasonable. I think you guys know Republicans and Democrats actually, I think, agree on about 80% of what we vote on up at the State House. Yeah, there's wedge issues every now and again. Even Governor Baker has been vetoed and overridden by the legislature. But ultimately, it's about reaching that compromise, and that's something that I understand and want to achieve.
Are you concerned about the state of the Republican Party in general? I don't mean their political leanings. We could do that discussion with you tomorrow, should you be the nominee. But the fact that the numbers are dwindling, and obviously I hope everybody knows, if you're registered unenrolled, you can choose either primary to vote in today. We should have made that clear at the top of the show. Are you concerned about the dwindling numbers for your own party in the state, Jeff Diehl?
Well, you know, I mean, the problem has been that for a long time, nobody's done anything to try to, you know, at least push a fairly conservative message to get people to want to be a Republican. So I think that, you know, we've got new leadership in 2019 of the state party. Before that, you know, I wasn't getting support from the Mass GOP. So, you know, I think now we're giving people a reason to get back involved again. They have candidates that I think people can believe in that are talking more about what's important to the average people than special interests or, you know, typical political talking points. And that's what I've always been about. Again, I was a 40 years old. I'd never been involved in politics in my life in 2010. And I ran and I beat an incumbent who was the vice chair of education. If you speak about the issues that matter to your community, you can win. And I think that's what Republicans need to get back to.
So, Jeff, it is election day. It's raining like crazy outside. What's your plan for today? Where are you going? What are you doing? And where are you going to be if it is a celebration tonight, celebrating tonight?
Oh, well, look, I'll be in Weymouth at a bar called, or a restaurant called Precinct 10 tonight for the victory party. My running mate, Leah Allen, should be joining me. We hope to have good news, obviously, for everybody. But I'm down in the South Coast right now in Fall River, and you know, we're just crisscrossing the state everywhere we can go to talk to people who are at polls and let them know that we thank them for their hard work to get the vote out. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be their nominee for the next 2 months for the general election.
You know, Jeff Teal, before you go, I mentioned at the top that both you and your opponent have agreed, should you win the primary today, to join us tomorrow, you'd do it in the studio. One of the last times you were in studio with us, you attempted to bribe Marjorie by giving her a bottled liquor. Is your intention to do that again tomorrow, should you be there?
Look, I was prepping her to move to Canada with that Canadian club whiskey.
But I'm bummed. Thank
right?
you.
Because yeah. Trump had just won.
So, Trump look, has just won. I went through the bottle in the first week, actually.
Marjorie.
Thank
Marjorie,
you.
Marjorie, when I win, I don't know what drink you're going to need when I win, but just let me know. I'll make sure we get you a steady stream.
Hey, Jeff.
Something strong, Jeff. No
good
question
luck,
about
and again,
it.
If Jeff Teal is the winner, he will be with us tomorrow. If Chris Doty is the winner, he'll be with us tomorrow. Jeff, lots of luck. It's really good to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and good luck today.
Take care.
You too.
Jeff Teal. Joining us now, is she here, I believe?
Yes.
Yes, she is one of the two remaining candidates for Attorney General on the Democratic side. That is Shannon Liss-Riordan. Shannon, welcome to the show. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. So first, just tell us what you're doing today. Where are you going? What you're going to be doing tonight? What's your plan for the day?
Well, I've been continued to be all across the state. Right now I'm in between Springfield and Worcester. I voted this morning in Brookline. I joined Mayor Wu at a polling place in Boston. I'm going to be in New Bedford tonight, then I'll be back in Boston. So getting out everywhere across the state.
So you were a short-lived, you ran for the Senate for a short period of time. Obviously, you're all in on the Attorney General thing. What's a takeaway? I don't mean on the issues. What's a big takeaway from you for months of campaigning across Massachusetts? What do you take home with it?
Well, I've been talking to voters all across Massachusetts for months, and I know that our message is resonating, that people understand this is a very important office that calls for a seasoned, experienced lawyer. That is who I am. I have been going up against some of the most powerful interests in this country for more than 20 years, and I've been winning. I have won back more than $500 million in stolen wages for working people. That is the kind of intensity and energy and skills and experience and passion I'm going to put into fighting for all of the people across Massachusetts, workers, consumers, the environment.
Shannon Liss-Riordan, you have been criticized by your opponent about self-funding your campaign to the tune, I think, of $9 million. You or your campaign have criticized Andrea Campbell in terms of dark money contributors with PAC stuff. What's your response to the criticism that's been directed at you?
Yeah, I think it's a cynical view that my opponent has that somehow the voters of Massachusetts can be bought. I'm just getting my message out, and I know that message is resonating. You know, I'm not a politician, so I don't come in with a silken political audience. I'm a lawyer. That is what I've been doing. I have been winning for the people for years. And the message is resonating. This is an important job. I'm the only candidate in the race who is an actual practicing lawyer. I am the only candidate who has run a law firm. My work has shaped industries and helped protect our rights across Massachusetts for more than two decades. I'm looking forward to bringing that experience to work and win for all the people across Massachusetts.
We're talking to Shannon Liss-Riordan, who's running on the Democratic ticket for Attorney General. So give us the major differences that voters should know about and how you would operate as Attorney General versus Andrea Campbell.
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm the only candidate who has run a law firm. I know how to do this. I will be ready on day one. I've got more than 23 years experience. I see this race as a job interview. I ask the people of Massachusetts to think about who would they hire to be their lawyer if they needed a lawyer. This is a job that is representing the people of Massachusetts. I'm so honored to have the support of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, former Boston Mayor Kim Janey, as well as the AFL-CIO and more than 50 unions across Massachusetts who represent more than 500,000 working people.
So is this fun? Tell the truth. Raise your right hand, Shannon Liss-Riordan. Is this campaigning like this fun?
I'm raising my right hand. Okay. I'm having so much fun. I'm a trial lawyer, remember, so I don't sleep. I burn the candle on all ends. So I have really enjoyed getting out there, talking with folks all across Massachusetts and hearing about what their needs are and what they are looking for from their next attorney general. I plan to serve all the people of Massachusetts, make the office more accessible for people who have all kinds of complaints. Your employer hasn't paid you properly, or a company is trying to scam you, or you're not getting the health care that you need. I'm going to be there for all of these issues and more, and I'm going to put my knowledge of how to use the legal system to work for everyone across Massachusetts.
Shannon Liss-Ridden, we really appreciate your time. Good luck tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. You are listening to Boston Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break. After we come back, we're going to talk with Diana DiZoglio. She's on the Democratic ticket, candidate for auditor. And after that, we're going to talk to Trenny Casey.
Who's
she?
Used
to be Trenny Kuznarek.
Oh,
now,
same person?
She is a married lady. She's going to be talking about sports up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. We have broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and Friday from the Boston Public Library.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's primary election day. Go out and vote, damn it. This 20-some percent thing is total BS as far as I'm concerned. Make an impact. Have an impact. We are live at the Boston Public Library, and we're continuing our tradition today that we've done for a couple of decades, Marjorie and I, inviting every single candidate in a contested statewide race to join us. They will all be here. We've talked to the two Republicans running for governor, Chris Doty, Jeff Diehl. One of the two Democrats for Attorney General, Shannon Liss-Ridden. One of the two Democrats running for Auditor, Chris Dempsey. The other Democrat running for Auditor is joining us now, State Senator Diana DiZoglio. Senator, it's good to talk to you.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. Great to be here. Thanks so much for the gracious invitation to speak with your listeners today.
We're thrilled to have you.
Thank you so much for joining us. So speaking of today, Election Day, pouring rain, Election Day, what are you doing? What's your strategy for today, Diana DiZoglio? What are you doing?
Honestly, I've run for office several times now. I'm former state representative, current state senator. Guys, I have a little bit of an echo back there. If anybody can help out with that, that would be great.
Oh, we'll work on it. We'll try.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So we're doing, same thing that we've always done, which is make sure we're calling everybody. We're encouraging people to get out to vote. Like you said, Jim, the low voter turnout is always a challenge when we have a primary election happening the day after Labor Day. People are just getting back from vacation. And getting the kids back to school. So it is a challenging day, plus the rain. But look, we're staying optimistic, we're staying positive, and we're calling folks and we're reminding folks on social media, sending out our emails, and hoping that people remember to come out and vote. It's an incredibly important election.
Diana DiZoglio, I worry, as we said to Chris Dempsey, that the vast majority of voters distracted by the end of summer. The election is the day after Labor Day, which is a nightmare. Hopefully that'll get changed in the future. Don't even know what the important functions of the auditor are. What are the most important ones to you, Senator?
Yeah, so the state auditor is the state's chief accountability officer. She is responsible for making sure the state agencies and state leaders are held accountable across the board. A lot of folks think of the state auditor's role in terms of finances only, mm-hmm. but actually she's the person that also holds state agencies accountable regarding things like qualitative issues, for example, procedures and processes across state government. A little bit about myself. Look, I was born to a 17-year-old single mom. I was raised housing insecure. We moved around quite a bit during my childhood, depending on where my mom could find work as a young single mom. I ended up graduating from public schools, going through our local community college, Middlesex Community College, and through a full financial scholarship to Wellesley, was able to become the first in my family to graduate. I know what it's like to struggle and to have to be scrappy to make ends meet. And I know how important it is that investments made through your tax dollars are used efficiently, effectively, and wisely, not only because it's another child's future opportunities that are put at risk with every wasted dollar, but also because we work hard for our tax dollars as working families in the state of Massachusetts. And we need to make sure that we have a proven watchdog who's able to go up to Beacon Hill as an ex-state auditor, speak truth to power, and make sure that we're keeping a close eye on how those tax dollars are being spent. Every wasted dollar is another climate change initiative that's passed over. It's another transportation issue that's passed over. We need to make sure that we are preserving those tax dollars. And I have committed to do a safety audit of the MBTA. I'm the only candidate in this race that's committed to auditing the legislature. And we have a lot of work to do implementing my social justice and equity audit plan, which can be found on my website, www.dianaforma.com. Please check that out. We have a lot of work to do regarding the state's diversity, equity, and inclusion components in our state contracting and procurement procedures. GBH has done some great reporting on this. Only 0.005% of state contracts actually go out to minority businesses. We have a lot of work to do on housing. We have a lot of work to do across the board. So I'm excited to get to work implementing my audit plan. And I do encourage folks to check out my website if you still have questions. I hope to earn your support.
Darren Jezaglia, we have less than a minute left, but tell us in that time, what's the major difference between you and your opponent, Chris Dempsey?
Look, I have a proven track record up on Beacon Hill of standing up and speaking truth to power, regardless of party affiliation. I am a Democrat. I am serving in my 10th year in the state legislature, currently serving as a state senator. What I have been most known for is championing issues of transparency, accountability, and equity. I'm the only candidate in this race who is going to be conducting a full audit and an investigation into the abuse of your tax dollars regarding taxpayer-funded non-disclosure agreements with silence, harassment, discrimination victims across state government. And I'm the only candidate in this race who's willing to conduct an audit of the state legislature. They should not be above the law. I'm also the only candidate committed to conducting a safety audit of the MBTA.
Thank you so much for your time
today. Good luck,
Senator.
Good luck today. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, everybody. Hope to see you out at the polls. Get out and vote.
Okay. We very
Get
much appreciate
that. Amen.
That was Diana Jezaglia. She is Democratic candidate for auditor. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Quick break. We'll be back with Treni Kuznarek. Nay, Treni. Nope. She's Treni Casey now. She used to be Treni Kuznarek. She's going to fill us in for the latest sports headlines up next. Again, Boston Public Radio, 89.7, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan live at the Boston Public Library, streaming online at youtube.com/GBH News. Just a programming note, we spoke to five of the candidates running for statewide office in contested primaries at the top of the show. In the middle of the show, we'll speak to all the candidates running for lieutenant governor of the Democratic side, and we'll end the show with the remaining candidates in all the contested races. We do this every primary or regular election day, final election day. And we're thrilled to be continuing it today. But first, Serena Williams supposedly played her final professional match of tennis on Friday, losing in the third round of the U.S. Open. Joining us to discuss the legendary career of the 23-time Grand Slam champion and the Saudi Golf Tour coming to town is a woman who is here wearing an I voted button. That would be Treni Casey. She is NBC Sports Boston reporter. And anchor. Hello there, Treni. And
hi, guys.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
For getting married.
Thanks.
I know.
He went through with it.
She's a newlywed.
He did.
He did.
Oh, he did.
Oh, yes.
He
I'm
just showed me
difficult.
Gorgeous pictures of you and your handsome husband and your gorgeous wedding dress, which is before we get to sports.
Yes.
Everything went well?
It was like better than I ever could have imagined.
Oh.
It was three. We did like a ton of, it was a long wedding. We're not. I know Indians tend to have, that's like a very Indian tradition. You have like a 3-day wedding.
They do?
It's usually epic and there are elephants. We didn't have the elephants, but we had the epic.
It was, really? Why didn't you have the elephants?
Well, because, I mean, you know, it's not really, they're hard to get in Vermont.
Can you do 60 seconds on Trenny Casey for those who were saying?
Yeah. Like, why am I changing my last name? I know it's weird, especially because I'm obviously super liberal and a feminist, and I think a lot of people were surprised. Quite frankly, Jim, I hate my last name was so hard to say. Kaczynarek is hard and it's long and it's Polish, and then you put it together with Trenny and it's a mouthful. And every time I go somewhere, I have to be like, it's T-R-E-N-N-I. Okay, what's your last name? Kaczynarek. Could you spell that too? And it's just, it's honestly, you go to the airport and it's like, you know, Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and is there a. And there's always a pause because they're trying to figure out my first name and they're trying to figure out my last name. But also, after getting married and like having a husband, I do realize that it's you know, we're not going to have children. We're still past that stage. We're both in our mid 40s and choose to not venture into that at this point. And so we're each other's family. And so it was kind of, as I like thought more about it, it is important to me to, you know, we're a family, we're the Caseys.
What's his first name, by the way?
Sean.
Now the thing though that you haven't explained,
not the baseball player, by the way,
I don't mean to be heavy about this, but I feel I have to ask it. He changed his name to Sean Kaczynarek. Why did he decide?
Well, because his first name is so common,
he
figured, and Sean Casey kept getting screwed. No, he did not. I actually said, if I had Casey, would you change it? And he was like, I would never change my name. To his credit, though, when I said I was going to change my name, I mean, to this day, he said, are you really going to go on the radio today and on TV and change your name?
Yep, she's done it.
And I said, I'm going to. And he said, you know, you don't have to. Like, this is who you are. This is who you've always been for your entire career. And I was like, yeah, but it's so much easier to pronounce for
everybody. I tell you, we're really happy for both of you. We look forward to seeing
you. And now you're done.
Thanks so much. For now, we are, yes.
Okay, so let's move to this Live Golf spectacle funded by Saudi Arabia. I read Tara Sullivan's piece in The Globe and some other things about it, and there seems to be an excitement, even though they're not on TV, about this sport that I predict is spelling change for the PGA, if not trouble for the PGA?
I mean, maybe. You know, she did say, so obviously we were out of town. I wasn't able to attend, and I didn't watch because, in fact, only 166,000 people watched it on YouTube. So this is not something that's, quite frankly, garnering a ton of attention. But it's new and it's shiny, right? Well, whether or not it sparks change, I think the biggest thing, Marjorie, is the money is so massive. Like Cameron Smith, who played, I think, through the final, is going to play through the FedEx Cup. And through the remainder of the PGA Tour season.
Is he the number two guy?
Yeah, he's gonna leave for Live Golf. And he was, what I liked about what he had to say is that he was honest. He's like, this is life-changing money. The money they are throwing at these guys is so incredible. But at some point, you also have to make money back. Like, I mean, I don't care how rich you are. You're wealthy because you're smart, right? You're a smart business person if you continue to amass wealth. And if this does not bring money back, how much longer can they continue to pay
forever.
These guys?
Forever. It's the Saudi government. I mean, can I tell you something? The two things. I read Tara Sullivan's piece.
But at some point, does it become an embarrassment to the Saudi government if it's not successful?
Well, I don't. Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe not.
Really,
it kind of seems
a couple
like a
things.
Spectacle to me.
One,
yeah,
I
with throwing the beer at
was
the
it Cameron Smith
fireworks.
Whoever, even though I am appalled by this whole thing with the Saudis and all this crap, tortured. Convolutions these golfers go through to explain why it's such a good idea. Who was the golfer? Was it Smith last week who said it's about the money?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I still don't like it, but at least one guy
is admitting
this is all about money.
I mean, let's be honest. If they came to you or me or Marjorie and said, you know what, guys, we need a radio voice or we need a sideline reporter and we're going to pay you $15 million a year, how could you? I'm going to be honest. I would probably put my morals
Can
aside.
Can I be honest?
You wouldn't.
I wouldn't do it.
Because you're
and
like
I mean,
a
and
much
I hesitate
better
to
human
say
than
that.
Me.
No, because she's going to mock me. And I know it.
It's just, like, think about that. That's
what I'm saying. It's been a nice duo
even,
here,
we're
Jim.
Not even
but
yeah, exactly.
We got to be real.
You got to be real. Like, it's like people who say they're going to keep working their day job if they win the lottery. I mean, that essentially is winning the lottery. If you sign a 3-year deal with $45 or $50 million guaranteed, like that, you are talking about life changing money, and these guys are signing deals that are 10 times that. We're talking 150 million.
It's not just that, though.
Guaranteed.
It's not just that. I mean, we've been doing tremendous business for decades now with the Chinese,
yes.
who are doing horrible things to their own people within their
Who's
border.
We? You mean our government?
Our government.
Yeah.
Joe Biden just went over and met with the crown prince in Saudi Arabia. So there's a lot of
it's not
around.
Even.
Were you good with that?
I wasn't good with that,
okay,
but I'm thinking.
So that's all you got to do. See, the question is, you know, by the way, just.
But do you, let me ask you this. Do you check the label of everything you buy to make sure?
No, I'm sure I have some
transcription. We're all buying exactly.
And that's
but
thing.
This is right in your face, by the way.
It is.
And I want to tell, by the way, I've told the story a few weeks ago. I'm going to tell it anyway because Ken Burns is coming to see us on Monday.
Ooh.
He has a new 6-hour documentary about the Holocaust. Margie and I are doing an event with Ken Burns and Lynn Novak at some big hall in town with thousands of people
when?
There. A couple of years
Hancock.
Ago. Came to see him. And at one point, Ken Burns, I won't tell you what the underlying thing was, turns to me and says, obviously you're a better person than I am, to me, just like you did. And obviously, and Margie interjected and said, I wouldn't go that far. And that was the end of that. In any case, so the one thing I will say about this, though, that I do like, and this is touched on by Tara Sullivan. I hate that this golf thing.
Yes.
I like that they were throwing beers, free beer out to people. I like
they don't
the
give
fireworks.
Them enough money either.
This and by the way, the baseball, a similar thing. There was a story the other day about the new first baseman for the
Red Sox,
who before his first game in the major leagues takes his socks, his shirt off and goes lies in the outfield just in his shorts and nothing else on his back. That's the kind of out-of-the-box kind of thing people should be doing in every sport. And while I condemn the Live Tour for their funding, their creativity should be adopted by the PGA.
Well, don't you think it's obvious
PGA
is going to change?
But do you really want, like, I don't know. I don't like their format. I don't like a shotgun start because there is something
Which
about
is weird.
Building up to that 18.
What is 18, a shotgun?
A shotgun start means everyone starts at the same time. So instead of having rolling tee times where, like, I would start at 7 o'clock. You would start at 7:06.
On hole number one.
On hole number one.
Oh, I don't like that. I
you would
know
start
that. Okay.
On hole one. You go 1 through 18 and
but
you
I
all start
But I meant the entertainment
the
value part of it.
Sure.
I
mean, if you like tossing T-shirts into the stands
Love
and
that.
Beer bottles and
well,
stuff.
Well, you know, I
mean,
wonder, because a lot of people that you hear that like to watch golf that aren't even golfers, they watch it because it's kind of like slow TV.
Yes.
It's sort of soothing and it's quiet.
Oh, I like to nap to
and
it.
And a little shot up from the tee on the 18th hole and all that kind of stuff. And the beautiful views all
beautiful
the time.
Beautiful views are huge.
I also think there's something to be said for it's fair. It's quiet, right?
It's quiet.
Tiger Woods is or Phil Mickelson or now Rory McIlroy is standing on the 18th and he's putting for a tournament and it is dead silent. And the minute he taps that ball, the place
erupts.
There's a crescendo to everything.
It is.
As opposed to it just being like everything now. You know, and listen, I love the NBA and I've grown to love the NBA, but if you go to an NBA game, it's music during the play and it's constantly things going on. And like, I actually went, and this is a decade ago. The Pittsburgh Pirates did an old time baseball game where for the entire game, they didn't do any in-game entertainment. Nothing on the video screen. It was amazing, Jim. It actually was amazing because you felt like you were watching baseball. And the people, of course, it was such a success that they were almost embarrassed because they're like, our whole job here is to do all of this other, you know, extraneous things around, I'm pointing to you.
Oh, Jamie.
That people, you know, there's all these other things going on. And like, that's what we do for a living. That's our job. And people liked it better when it was just quiet. I think there's a happy medium. I think maybe the PGA,
so
and I think the PGA is going to have to make some adjustments because according at least to Tara Sullivan's article, and then I forget who wrote sort of the more nuts and boltsy article of it, there were a fair number of young people there. And young people aren't exactly the target audience for golf right now. And if that's who's going to be tuning in at some point, they may be getting in on the ground level of something in the PGA. The PGA Tour, at least, at the very least, has to pay attention.
So we're talking to Trenny Casey.
I know. It's going to be hard.
Our sports expert here from Boston, NBC Sports Boston. So we're going to talk to you about the Patriots' offense. However, we read Beth Tytel's great piece about people who signed up to get Patriots season tickets like decades ago. Some guy finally got the tickets. He's
69-year-old bus
and
driver.
He's a grandfather and isn't sure he wants to go to Gillette anymore. That's amazing.
Okay, so I'm going to make fun of this a little bit because I come from a place where this kind of story is like, oh, you had to wait 20 years for tickets. Do you know that people put unborn children on a list at Green Bay Packers?
That's right.
Some people die
that.
Before you ever get tickets. Like the waiting list is not 2 decades long. It's like 50, 60 years long.
Oh, my God.
Like, you people will literally But like when the baby is like in utero and they've named it and they found out what it is, they will put the child, when the list opens, they will put that child on the list. There are rules in Green Bay that you cannot, you can only put, I think the only people you can pass your tickets, like will your tickets to, are direct next of kin. So like grandparents, I think, can give them to grandchildren. Parents can certainly give them to children, but like you can't give them to cousins. Like it stops at a certain point within a certain portion of the family. Family tree, because they are so coveted. So while I get what they're saying, that it's, that's just the NFL now. I mean, that's the NFL. If you have a successful football team, everybody wants to go. It's a huge, it's an experience. And that's just, I think, the price of being good. I will say this, if the Patriots for some reason go through a prolonged time of mediocrity, or maybe even not being good, those names will come off that list far more quickly.
You know what I don't get? I totally understand wanting a season ticket, as you say, when Brady is playing the greatest strings right. in history. The thing I don't understand is there's no better television sport
I know.
Than football. There's no worse sport to sit in the freezing cold at
I know.
Than football. One game a year. If somebody's nice enough to invite me, I'd love to go to a game. It's great. One game. The notion that people wait in line for decades to sit in the Green Bay, even colder,
oh, yeah,
by the way.
Yeah. I was so happy. We're going to the Packers-Patriots game at Lambeau. Yeah, oh, it's my wedding gift to my now husband.
Oh, that's great.
But it's October 2nd, and I was so happy when the games came out, because I was like, thank God we don't have to go there in December when it's freezing. I will say this, though, Jim. Like, we have a friend. He goes to games with his dad. He's been going to games with his father since he was a child. And so there's a tradition to it,
understood.
I think, for a lot of people. And let's be honest, there's also, if you can get on the list and you don't want to go, like maybe you only want to go to one or two games a year, then you just sell them and you make that money back to pay for your tickets. If you're a business person, you use, I think there are like many different ways that people use their season tickets. They're beneficial to have. And if they are good again, if Mac Jones becomes the second coming of Tom Brady and you have season tickets, then when they're winning Super Bowl, like you get priority to all the playoff games and all these other things. So there is, I think, still value in having actual physical tickets.
By the way, people are texting when I said I wouldn't take $15 million for the Saudis for a radio show. Make me an offer and then we can talk.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an abstract. So we're talking to Trini Casey.
Very easy to say
Sports
no.
Boston.
So let's talk about Serena Williams just retired from tennis. Very magical. Last week, as several of the headlines have pointed out, we have a little sound from her after her final match, and she was talking about the past few decades of her career and her family, and it's pretty tearful. Here it is.
I just thank everyone that's here, that's been on my side so many years, decades, oh my gosh, literally decades. But it all started with my parents. And they deserve everything, so I'm really grateful for them. Oh my God, these are happy tears, I guess. I don't know. And I wouldn't be Serena if it wasn't Venus, so.
Pretty good.
So I finally watched King Richard.
Oh, about her father.
I finally watched it on the plane. And
wasn't it great?
Well, it was a perfect time to watch it because even I guess, wasn't aware how much Serena was in Venus's shadow at the beginning, which makes, if you've seen the movie, to me, that moment is even more poignant, where, you know, the two of them, it was Venus who
was the big star. She's
a big star. She's also a little bit older, right? Uh-huh. But when they first took them to the coach who coached Pete Sampras and I think McEnroe, the coach at the time saw something in Venus but said, I'll only coach her. He wouldn't coach Serena. And so Serena always had to fight for everything. But in this movie, and I think it's fairly accurate because I think both Williams sisters had a lot to say. Like, they both promoted it's not a documentary, obviously, but it's I think, pretty
Will
true
Smith.
To
form.
Yeah.
You know, the father said that he knew, Richard Williams knew from an early age that Serena would be bigger. He said, Venus may be number one, but you'll be the best that ever played.
Is there tension
again, whether
them?
Or not, it doesn't seem like it.
Were they in the Olympics when you did the Olympics?
They were. They did play doubles together, and I think they only, you know what, I actually think they might have lost in the first round because I don't remember if I ever actually interviewed the two of them together. And I know Venus's only opportunity to win a medal, and she did end up winning silver in mixed doubles in the 2016 Olympics. But I think they might have lost. I don't think I ever had a chance to interview them together, but I think they're quite close. despite everything they went through, and having to compete against one another. Yeah, I think they still... I mean, listen, who knows, right? Like, we don't know what actually goes on behind the scenes.
Speaking of who knows, I don't know if you know the answer to this one either. She has 23 Grand Slam titles, Serena Williams, so one short of the all-time
Margaret
Court, the Australian. I didn't even know Margaret Court was alive. And then yesterday she speaks, and she basically says, I've always admired Serena's work, and she's never admired or commented about mine. And I had no idea what was behind that. And I did a little bit of reading last night. And it seems that Court has taken a lot of crap for coming out against same-sex marriage. Is that what led to her sort of fall from grace, such as it was?
I mean, I don't even know if it was so much a fall from grace. It's just, I think, more the era in which she played, where it was so much earlier, like so much prior to big television contracts, a big world, you know, Women's Tennis Association, TV, right? Like all of the things, because if my memory serves, she played even before Billie Jean King did.
Yeah, but what's his face? Aaron Judge is potentially going to break Roger Maris's record for the American League home runs, and they talk about Maris.
But
all the
think
time.
About how big baseball was at the
That's
time. Women's
point.
Tennis.
That's a good point. You're right.
In the in the 50s and 60s, it was really until Billie Jean King sort of forced the notion. It was sort of an afterthought, like women's sports. Whereas baseball, if anything, now it's amazing they're still talking about Aaron Judge in relation to Roger Maris, because many think that the players who played in that era were actually better, you know, true peer baseball players, just because of the way the sport, nutrition, and everything else is evolved. I think it's a little, can I be honest, when I saw the headline of the story, I thought, why now, Margaret Court? Like, why? You had all these years where she's been chasing your number, and she's never brought it up until now.
Yeah.
So now you want more, now you want attention, and now you want the spotlight to be back on you. And I'm sure that that's difficult, but I also feel a little bit like, you know, you're a grown woman, unless Serena has done something, unless she is actually actively talked about you in a negative manner, I'm not sure why you have to make it about you. That was the first reaction.
Quick
to
question
story.
Before you go. What was it like at your polling place when you voted this
morning? There actually were a couple people. There was
Where'd
two
vote,
people.
By the way? So it's pretty you want easy. To say or you don't?
Yeah, I'm just happy to say it's in my, it's where I live.
Okay.
So it's like in, it's, I live in the North End waterfront area, and it's right there. So I literally just had to like walk downstairs.
And what was it like?
But there were people there. There was two women in front of me and somebody walked in behind me. I mean, like nothing like it is on a presidential election day, you know, where I used to vote at this, like at this school in the line. You know, I remember the year that it was Trump versus Hillary. I mean, the line was down the block and around the corner. So it wasn't like that. But these elections are so important. Like everything that happens that you complain about, it's local government that makes the change.
Hey, so Trenny, Trenny Casey, congratulations to you
it's
and to Sean.
While.
Hope
Thank
to
you.
See him soon.
We're
Thanks
very
so
happy
much.
To have you back, and I'm glad everything
we
went well. Nice and you looked back. Absolutely spectacular. Gorgeous bridal dress, Trenny Casey. She's also, besides being a new bride, she's the anchor reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. We're going to be talking with more candidates, as Jim said, later in the show. But up next, we're going to talk to the ACLU's Carol Rose. She's here to discuss their election campaigns to increase voter participation and the appointment of a special master in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents caper. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, live from the Boston Public Library.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we're back at the Boston Public Library. Today, heading in hour number two with Carol Rose, Executive Director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, here to explain that decision in the Mar-a-Lago search case by a judge in favor of the man who nominated her for the position, Donald Trump. And it's Lee Pelton from the Boston Foundation joining us on the overworked and underpaid field of care work and what needs to be done to support the people supporting us. We'll also talk student loan debt forgiveness and more.
Then we'll return to the candidates on this rainy election day in Massachusetts, specifically the ones running for the second highest seat in the state, Lieutenant Governor. Democrats Kim Driscoll, Eric Lesser, and Tammy Gouveia will all call in. Then we'll shift our focus to the national stage with CNN's John King. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We'll be right back. Houston Rowdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are back at the Boston Public Library, where we broadcast from every Tuesday and every Friday. Hello again, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm good.
It's our first day back. We were off for a long time.
We were back for a
long time. Marjorie particularly was off for
I think you were off for longer, actually.
Doesn't really matter. But the point I was trying to make is what we're doing today is what we do in every primary.
You took three of my vacation days,
I did take three of my vacation days without telling her, by the way, and unfortunately
That's
HR
right.
let her know. What we're doing today is what we do in every primary and final election day. We invite every single candidate in a contested primary, if it's a primary day, to join us, Democrats and Republicans. They have all agreed to participate today. We had five in the beginning of the segment. We'll have the three lieutenant governor candidates in about 45 or 50 minutes, and then the two candidates for Secretary of State and Andrea Campbell, the other candidate. We spoke to Shanalyst Reardon for Attorney General, so we will hit them all today. And by the way, we should, if you didn't listen to the top of the show, these are not our typical interviews that go 20, 25 minutes or a half hour. They're five-minute opportunities for candidates to make their final pitch.
Right. These are not the tough interview questions thing for which Jim Browdy has gained a reputation.
Well, most of our listeners think I'm not tough enough.
Yeah,
but regardless.
These are softballs, as we say.
Okay, and yes, we are live for those who are saying, are you really back from vacation? Sadly, for some of you, we are back from vacation. Having said that, joining us now after that long introduction is the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. That would be Carol Rose. Hello, Carol.
Hello. Nice to be here, and happy voting day.
Well, before we get to all the voting issues, I want to talk about this special master that's going to be appointed to oversee this confiscating or taking all these documents to Mar-a-Lago, many of which are classified or top secret or that kind of thing.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's really shocking. You know, I think the judge in appointing a special master on this, it's really unusual because the documents were seized pursuant to a search warrant, which is a pretty common thing to have happen. And there's sort of two issues that arise from it. You know, one is this whole question of executive privilege against the executive branch itself for somebody who's no longer in office. So that in and of itself...
Because the Justice Department is part of the same branch.
It's part of the same branch, right. So that in and of itself is really unusual. But the other thing that's even as troubling, if not more troubling, is the fact that there seems to be sort of two sets of laws. The one is the set of laws that Judge Cannon raised with regard to being concerned about Donald Trump's privacy issues. But that doesn't exist when anybody else gets a search warrant. I mean, if you are subject to a search warrant, a probable cause search warrant, which this was, and you say, well, I'm going to hide my documents, my false tax returns in my diary, and that's private, that isn't an excuse. Or I'm going to steal some diamonds and put them into my personal wardrobe. That's not an excuse. So, in effect, what the judge seems to be saying is that there's sort of two sets of laws, one for Donald Trump and the other for all the rest of us. And that's not equal justice.
Yeah,
you know, a couple of points here. The media correctly has gone out of their way, considering that virtually nobody, including most sane Republican legal experts, have said this is extraordinary, it's shocking that she's doing this. And by the way, she is saying that the Justice Department can't do any further investigation, including questioning of witnesses about the documents, till the special master is finished. Here's the question that I don't think was explored adequately at all in the extensive coverage this weekend. She, the Trump appointee, and by the way, most Trump appointees on the 60-plus cases filed around the election ruled against Donald Trump in virtually every single case. Here is an exception here. She will pick the special master. What happens when she picks someone from the Federalist Society like she is, who isn't like a lunatic like John Eastman or Rudy Giuliani, who's out there, who is a quiet Trump supporter like she is, who she knows has great sympathy for the former president, but doesn't have a paper trail like an Eastman or a Giuliani. And the special master is as in the tank as she appears to be.
Right.
What happens then?
Well, then I think it really undermines respect for the rule of law. I mean, because if we have one set of rules for Donald Trump, who's not a president right now, right? We have one set of rules for him and a different set of rules for the rest of us, then it really undermines this whole notion of equality before the law. And I think that's not only detrimental to this particular investigation, which clearly it is, but it really is detrimental to our whole system of law, the rule of law, and faith in our democracy. And I think that's incredibly damaging. And I really hope that the Department of Justice appeals and that the 11th Circuit will overturn this, because it's, I think it's tremendously damaging from a systemic point of view, not just in terms of this particular investigation.
Well, you mentioned the appeal in the 11th Circuit. Many commentators have said that, well, the appeal could drag this out endlessly, and the 11th Circuit is one of the most conservative courts in the entire nation.
Except for maybe the Supreme Court.
So what does this mean? Besides the rule of law
considerations. Supreme Court ruled against Trump, too, by the way, 8-1 with Ginny Thomas's husband being the only outlier. Go ahead.
But what does this mean for this investigation itself? I mean, this is pretty big deal stuff, especially when there have been reports about nuclear documents involving.
Codes,
and sources and methods and all that kind of stuff. I mean, does this mean this will drag on for another year or 2 years?
Oh, it could drag on, and then it gets closer and closer to 2024. So, I mean, this just really will undermine, I think, the public faith in our judiciary, which already has been undermined by the Supreme Court, and I think it will really undermine the overall public sense of whether or not the rule of law exists for everyone.
And if Trump is a candidate in 2024, does this investigation simultaneously continue while he's running for office?
You know, Marjorie, I think what he's trying to do is to delay the investigation long enough so that then he can become a candidate, and then it becomes hard to say, well, isn't this a politically motivated investigation? So that's why the Department of Justice is trying to move both methodically and expeditiously at the same time, because they want to find out what's going on before it becomes more politicized than what it already has.
But if they appeal, then they're not going to be moving expeditiously.
Well, they have no choice.
Well, in all fairness, judges are not idiots. They're not captive of Donald Trump's lawyers. If it turns out the judges want to expedite this because they believe this Judge Cannon's decision was as unjust or shocking as you do, they can expedite those things, too. I mean, they can.
Well, I guess it depends, once again, as we talked about endlessly during the Trump presidency, he has rather, some would say, revolutionized the judiciary by his ability to appoint so many justices, including federal judges.
All of whom voted against him in his election cases.
Well, that
all
was
of whom.
They were not all Trump people.
No, but every Trump judge who had an opportunity to rule on a petition or a lawsuit filed by Trump's lawyers around the election, every single one ruled against them.
Well, we have a Trump justice in this case, which seems to not always.
And so I think what's going to be interesting now is if other people try to raise this defense. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of search warrants that go out. And, you know, let's say they get your cell phone because you've used your cell phone for drug dealing. And then suddenly, but that cell phone also has stuff about your therapist and also has stuff about your private life, right?
How'd you know it has stuff about my therapist?
Sorry about that, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agreed not to tell. No, but, so you don't get that as a defense. Right.
Right.
You can't say, well, you seized my phone that had criminal stuff on it, and therefore you can't look at anything else. It's truly unheard of. It's really unprecedented. So the question then becomes, either everybody gets to raise that defense, and let me tell you, people will be raising it, or alternatively, there's a different set of rules for Donald Trump than for everyone else. And as, you know, now Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote when she was on the D.C. Circuit, our presidents are not kings.
Right. They're
not
kings.
We shouldn't treat them as kings.
But just to clarify, because you guys are lawyers and I'm not, my understanding is that if there were a search warrant for Joe or Jane Smith, regular people, and they did get their therapist reports or some other thing, unless they're relevant to the case, they're not going to be reading their therapy reports in the middle of the trial.
Right, but they don't pause the criminal investigation.
Okay. Well, that's the other thing.
That's the big thing, the pausing of the investigation,
which she obviously did not have to do. She could have appointed the special master without doing that, correct?
Exactly.
Since
we
mentioned Clarence Thomas, very briefly, since we saw you last, there's yet another state legislative leadership that we learned that Ginny Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, reached out to, urging them to overturn the election results. I think it was Wisconsin. Arizona, and then Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any vehicle for looking into the behavior, not only of Ginny Thomas, and she's a private citizen, is there any vehicle for looking into the behavior and the potential ethical violations of her husband?
Yeah, Harvard Law School professor Larry Tribe thinks that there are some criminal statutes that they could look at that would require him to recuse himself, that if he fails to do so. But otherwise, it doesn't seem to be any way to force a Supreme Court justice to recuse themselves if, in fact, they have a conflict of interest. And it's pretty evident that Clarence Thomas has a conflict of interest on these issues that his wife is involved with. And so, you know, one, if his good conscience, which I think we've always relied on norms, right, and now all these norms are breaking down, we might need to have Congress pass a law.
Can I quote Marjorie Egan
what,
here?
About John Roberts?
Yes. John, you have said repeatedly, how dare John Roberts say I'm
going
to get to the bottom of the leak
of
the Dobbs decision overturning Roe, but not one peep about the grotesquely likely unethical behavior of one of his justices.
He was full of baloney when he talked about his concern for the integrity of the court, the reputation of the court. Obviously, he doesn't. I mean, that was...
Roberts.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think that's, you know...
He's
really,
lost his way, some would say.
I think the court has lost its way, and I think it's going to be important for another branch of government to be able to step in and pass a law. And that's why it matters that everybody votes.
By the way, did you see Jamie Raskin is running to be chair of the Oversight Committee
because
Jerry Nadler beat Carolyn Maloney,
which
would really be incredible. We're talking to Cal Rose, the head of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts.
So it is Election Day, and we're getting reports via text from not exactly overwhelming crowds at polling places around the Commonwealth. What are you doing to try to launch... you are launching these voter education series.
Yes, so this is something that we started about 6 years ago with What a Difference a DA Makes. It's a voter education campaign because the ACLU doesn't endorse candidates. We're a nonpartisan organization. But we do voter education for a few reasons. One is to get out the vote so people become educated and exercise their right to vote. It's an important franchise. And the other is that they get to know what's happening in some of these down ballot races, what's called, you know, not just the top level, but things like district attorneys. And also now this time we're doing it with Know Your Sheriff campaign. And it's really interesting because we did a poll early on that showed the vast majority of people didn't know who their sheriff was, didn't know that they were elected, didn't know that they only report to the voters. They don't work for the governor or anybody else. And same thing with district attorneys. And yet they have tremendous power over people's lives, thousands of people's lives. And what we learned is when we've had more than 15 different candidate forums. We're working with the Boston Public Library and with the Northampton Public Library and having forums for candidates. And when people find out how powerful sheriffs are and how powerful district attorneys are, the voting increases dramatically. And so what we're trying to do is to get people to be engaged. You know, because democracy is a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it becomes. And so against some of these attacks on our democracy and the rule of law that we were talking about earlier, if ordinary people get out and exercise their franchise, not just for the top of the ballot, but for these down ballot races, all of a sudden we can begin to effect change and we become a better democracy and a stronger democracy. So that's what really these campaigns of Know Your Sheriff and What a Difference a DA
Makes. By the way, it's great you're doing it. It's really terrific. But two questions relating to that. So I know you don't endorse candidates. The most contentious race in Massachusetts has been right here, Suffolk County.
Absolutely.
DA. Charges against the incumbent appointed by Charlie Baker Hayden to fill out the term of Rachel Rollins, that he deep-sixed an investigation into a transit cop. He says he didn't. It's a back and forth. He said kind of thing. And then Ricardo Arroyo, the Globe reporting that when he was in high school, he engaged in... sexual assault, I guess. Is that the proper noun there?
Forcing someone to perform oral sex.
He says, I didn't do it. He said the cops never spoke to me, even though the police record says they did speak to him and his lawyer. He asked the judge to release the records, which is extraordinary. They did. He released part of the records to say it was, quote, unfounded. The Globe went out of its way to say unfounded 15 years ago means something very different from what it means now.
And we don't know where the records came from in the first place.
Well,
where
he's saying the records. He's also filed an ethical complaint against the incumbent guy, saying one of the detectives on the case is now Hayden's driver. He thinks that proves. So what do you advise a voter in Suffolk County when all this stuff came up within 2 weeks of the election
day? I think it's a really hard situation. And, you know, and it really shows how people are now paying attention to the DA races. I mean, up until last time around, we almost never had since 1986, we hadn't even had a contested district attorney race, right? So I don't
know
enough of the facts. But now that people want to be district attorney, I think it's incumbent upon all of us, the Globe, you all of us, to pay attention to these races and maybe pay attention earlier on. So whatever's going on between these two candidates, that would have come out a lot sooner. So
voters
could vote
their conscience.
Well, if it were
not for the Globe reporting, we wouldn't know 90% of this.
Exactly.
You know, speaking of that, I want to get you on the record on something that I asked you about a couple of weeks ago. I think you know that Marjorie and I talked when the late Senator Brian Joyce was proposing a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Governor's Council, which we totally supported. He has since no longer with us. And it's not going to be abolished. It had to be a constitutional amendment anytime soon. It's a really important job. I would assume almost nobody knows who the Governor's Councilor is.
Right.
There are eight of them, which means their districts are as big as Congress people in this state.
And they're the people who decide, who make recommendations on who should become judges. So
not recommendations, final word.
Right. But now that's before
us again. Commutations, pardons. And so, one, I want you to commit that you're going to do a know your governor's counselor in the next round.
Well, I, you know, because since I was last here, I actually wrote an op-ed about this and put it out and said why it really matters. Know who your governor's counsel is. So I actually completely agree with you, and I would love to commit to have the ACLU do a voter education.
So do it.
Those are every
those are every
2 years.
By the way, we don't endorse candidates on the air either. But you, one race I've followed, Mara Dolan, who in the spirit of full disclosure we both know, public defender, has never been a public defender, is running against the incumbent, Marilyn Petito Devane. Do you remember when she was last on our show?
I think it was during the hair salon incident.
When she threw a curling iron at a person, and she admitted it on the air. She has she said she's endorsed by Jim McGovern.
Tempers at flare at the beauticians has been my experience.
She said she's
never know.
Endorsed by Jim McGovern. She is not endorsed by Jim McGovern.
Wow.
She accused Mara Dolan of some kind of fraud thing. It was so bad, it was her closing statement at a debate, that the debate tape had to be edited at the end to make clear there was no, and does the average person, I assume they're both campaigning fairly seriously, a person with broad experience would be the first public defender against someone misrepresenting who our support is. At least two governor's counselors, one incumbent, one former, have come out against her, which is almost unheard of.
Right.
Isn't that a problem that it's so far under the radar that it's insane?
Well, it is a problem that it's so far under the radar. And so as we've seen, I mean, we weren't sure when we first started out doing, you know, what a difference a DA makes, that people would pay attention. And the outpouring was huge. And now we have contested DA races. Same thing now we're seeing this with sheriffs. The response has been extraordinary. I think paying attention to the governor's council races and their every 2 years is really important. That's why I wrote the op-ed last week, and that's why I really think that it's important that we all pay attention, because these down-ballot races are where really important things happen, not to mention city councils, school boards, and all of these other races.
Well, the reason Brian Joyce, the late Brian Joyce, wanted to get rid of the governor's council is when you go to a governor's council meeting, which I haven't been in several years, I should say, but I did used to go when I was at the Herald. And you couldn't believe it. You couldn't believe these were the people that were going to put judges in office. And it was like the OK Corral. And there was a free-for-all, people ranting and raving.
Exactly. And now we know how important who is a judge, what a difference a judge makes, right? And so if we have the governor's council deciding who the judges are going to be, not to mention things like commutations and pardons, it's really important who's serving on the governor's council. So I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I think the ACLU as a nonpartisan organization has a great role to play here in helping local people to get educated about these races and to know that their vote really makes a difference, because so few people do vote for these
races. We should
be
clear. I want to be totally clear here. It is not constitutionally, you may still run for public office even if you have thrown a curling iron at someone. Am I not? You're the constitutional expert. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
So
I think
it's not a bar. It may be a consideration when you're voting, but it's not a bar.
Indeed, it might be a consideration.
Is that a consideration? Okay.
Oh, my God. People should go to those. They're open to the public. You can check them out. They're better now. They are better now.
No, but with all due respect, I think you're sort of missing the point.
What's the point?
If eight of them were fabulous.
Right.
The fact that the average person has no idea who they are,
I think eight,
is a problem.
Eight
don't
may
you
be
think?
A little bit more, really generous, I think.
I didn't say it. You know, I was saying theoretically.
I think the most important thing is that people, you know, information is power in the hands of the voters. Information is power. And so our job is to make sure people have the information they need on both what the power for sheriffs, district attorneys, governor, council is, and what the individual candidates believe, because we have them fill out forms and answer questions, and people can go to Know Your Sheriff, ACLU of Massachusetts.org, Know Your Sheriff, and take a look and find out what different people have before you go to vote today, which is incredibly important. That
and in 2 years,
vote.
They'll be able to go to Know Your Governor's Council.
And Know Your Governor's Council.
Okay, here in the audience at the library, raise your hand if you know who your governor's counselor is, and don't lie. Raise your hand if you know.
Nobody knows. Oh, we have one gentleman
are
back there.
Are you lying or are you telling the truth? Okay, one guy in the whole damn audience knows who their governor's counselor is. Is that appalling?
Yes.
Is that, I don't mean, I'm not being critical of you. It's the system. It's not, right. Well, you should know who
so,
the hell it is.
So we only have 2 minutes left here, but very quickly, tell us what's going on with the Framingham cops and drones.
Well, right. So this is a really interesting situation. So the ACLU Technology for Liberty program for a long time has been paying attention to new technologies coming online in secret that people don't know about. And so one of the things we're trying to do is to make sure, speaking of citizen control, that there's citizen control over police surveillance, or CCOPs. And in Framingham, we were able to work with citizens of Framingham to, when we found out, and therefore they found out, that their police department was going to get drones, as many police departments do. We worked with them and worked with the police department to try to get some checks and balances and a policy that would say you can't, if you're using a drone for a good purpose, you know, finding a lost child or something like that, or an elderly person who's wandered off, that's one thing. But if you're using it for face surveillance technology or to surveil political protests or to use it without a warrant or to go into somebody's private home or private property, you can't do that. So we were able to get some restrictions, and it's a pretty good policy. I mean, and we'd like to make it even stronger and more protective of individual rights and civil liberties, and the Framingham Police Department has said they're open to working with this. So that's a really good thing. And we hope it'll become a model for all of the police departments. And we have an app on our Data for Justice website that people can go and see, is there a drone in my town or city? Does my police department have that? And do they have privacy protections so that you can't have these kinds of technologies that track you or use face surveillance technology and sort of track you wherever you go, whether you're going to your therapist appointment or going to seek health care or going to, you know, visit your paramour, whatever it is. It's nobody's business, and the police shouldn't be using drones for those kinds of reasons.
That campaign is called No, what is it?
It's CCOPs, Citizen Control Over Police Surveillance.
Oh, okay.
It's because we think that people should know.
It's not called What a Difference a Drone Makes? Is that what I was trying to...
No, but you know, I think we're going to change it now.
Yeah, I think
yeah. Go drones.
Carol,
I kind of like that
you.
One.
Thank you.
Did you
all.
Vote yet
okay.
Or you didn't vote yet?
I did. I voted early because we
the
passed the
like
Votes Act.
Oh.
No, I voted early. And as now today...
voted early. Oh, meaning not today. You voted
yeah,
early.
I voted early. And I think about 500,000 people did. So people are exercising their right. We just passed that. And again, more democracy is better.
My friends calling me, know what I do for a living, calling me and asking me who should I vote for on their ballot. They hadn't heard of half the people, and I tried to tell them what was going on.
Tell them to go to the aclum.org website.
That's right. That's what I should have done.
Nice to see you, Carol Rose.
Thank you all.
Okay,
thank
we've
you.
Been speaking with Carol Rose, Executive Director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Thank you very much, Carol. Coming up, Lee Pelton of the Boston Foundation will discuss a new report on the struggle of care workers in Massachusetts who are making almost nothing. He's next on Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming online at youtube.com/GBH News. You've heard me say for years and years, decades actually, Marjorie and I have been inviting every candidate in a contested statewide race to make their final pitch to our listeners on the show. Every single one we invited has accepted. We've heard from five so far, the three lieutenant governor candidates on the Democratic side in about 25 minutes. At the end of the show, the two candidates for Secretary of State on the Democratic side, and Andrea Campbell for Attorney General. We already heard from Shannon Liss Reardon for Attorney General. So please stay tuned, particularly if you're among the 70-plus percent who are insanely contemplating not voting. We're joined now by Lee Pelton. Lee is the president of the Boston Foundation. He joins us monthly, and in full disclosure, he serves on the GBH Board of Trustees. Lee Pelton, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you on this beautiful, sunny day.
Yes,
yeah,
nice
it's great. But it's a good day to come back from vacation because it would be really depressing if it was 80 degrees and sunny out. At least it's raining
indeed,
and chilly.
Indeed.
So I know the Boston Foundation is working, is partnering with this Democracy Works to support voters. So it's Election Day, even though it is a lousy day and raining. What are you doing?
Well, we've partnered with, as you said, it's called Democracy Now, and they have something called Turbo Vote. catchy name.
Catchy.
You can see. And you can go online. In fact, you could go to the Boston Foundation, tbf.org, and you could look for Turbo Vote and actually sign up for it. And it will take in your information, your address. It will allow you to register. If you haven't registered, it'll show you how to register online. It will remind you of registration dates and election dates. You'll get these on your phone, actually.
Nice.
You sign up online. And it'll also give you information about the ballot for for the state or for your district and so on and so forth. So it's very useful. It obviously increases access, and hopefully it facilitates people voting, which is not something that we've done very well in the state and in the city. You know, I think about the mayoral race last year, historic race, two women on the ballot.
Yeah.
Two women, no men. One, a person of color. 29% of registered Bostonians voted in that election. 71% did not.
By the way, I want to say, speaking of Turbo Vote, I got a text last night. It said, "Hi, Jim. It's Turbo Vote. The Massachusetts primary election is tomorrow, 9/6. Get ready to vote. One, confirm that you're registered." And just to clarify what you said, there's not same-day vote registration yet in Massachusetts. It would tell you where to register for the final, which obviously is a couple months away. Find your voting location. There's a link for that, too. You may need to present ID, et cetera, et cetera. Already voted. Thanks for making your voice heard. If you want more information on the voters, here's where you go. Phone number, link. It's a terrific service. However, it seems to me when I got this last night, I said to myself, the person who most needs TurboVote is the person least likely to register for TurboVote. So, I mean, I'm a pretty good voter. I take it, I mean, I know we all do, pretty seriously. What do you do for those who don't think there's a difference or don't think it matters enough to spend even 30 minutes of their day to cast a ballot? That's
a great point, because what we're doing at TBF is to partner with other organizations and nonprofits, actually, to make this more visible so that more people will, in fact, take advantage of this opportunity. And so you'll be hearing more about that. We're going to be very public about that going forward.
Do you get involved in legislative campaigns? I mean, for example, I've written about this, and a lot of people have written about it. You know, should there be election day off? Should there be Sunday voting or Saturday and Sunday voting, like I think there is in many countries in the world? Deval Patrick told me he thought if the voting numbers remained horrible, when I wrote a piece for the Globe magazine, mandatory voting should be something that should be considered, as a bunch of Western democracies in the world do. Are there reforms that you think need to happen in addition to same-day registration, which I
assume
is sport? Yeah.
I do. And I'm going to tell you, I was in a state where voting turnout was high, where there was not same-day registration, but it was vote by mail. You could only vote by mail. You have to register it by a certain...
Is this Oregon?
This is Oregon.
Okay.
Oregon, yes. You would register by a certain date. I think this year it's October 18th. Then you would receive your ballot. This is for the national elections, general elections. And then you would receive your ballot in the mail about 3 weeks in advance. It would have a barcode or a QR code with your identity on it, not someone else's identity. And you'd sit around a kitchen table and have discussions with your families about this candidate or that candidate. Uh-huh. You fill it out, you seal it, you can either mail it in or drop it off at the several ballot
boxes
throughout the state. And it worked.
So there was no going to the polls the day of election and voting in Oregon? I didn't know that.
No.
Wow. How come?
And there was, there was no need to do that.
Because of the voting.
Yeah, because of the voting. You know, and I get it. And there's this
what
sort
about
of
the bake sales.
That's what I want to get to, is the bake sales. This sort of creamy New England charm around our democracy.
Yeah.
You know, and we have these town hall meetings where six people show up. The same six people show up at every town hall meeting. They devour all the donuts and drink all the coffee. but is that democracy? No, I don't think so. And so I do believe that some consideration ought to be given to a mandatory vote by mail that would increase access and would increase participation among a lot of different groups.
How about this? If you vote, you get a donut. Now, that would be a big draw.
For you, I know. It would be.
Exactly. We're talking to Lee Pelton. He's the head of the Boston Foundation.
I was saying this before when we were talking with Carol Rose from the ACLU about voting and the reference. You know, what a difference a DA makes, now what a difference a sheriff makes. And they're talking about doing this with the governor's council in the future, or she was anyway. But it is surprising to me. Like I was saying to her this weekend, because people know what I do for a living. My friends know what I'm doing for a living. And you know, there are people that are paying attention and they're working and living their life, calling last minute to say, what about the Attorney General race? You know, what about the governor's race? What about this race? And I was kind of stunned how many people really have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
We always blame young people for not knowing what's going on. Well, these are people that are 40, 50, 60 and 70 don't know what's going on.
Right. I think I heard earlier Carol Rose was talking about voter education and literacy and so on. And so we need probably to do a better job than we currently do. But I think the major issue is access.
Yeah.
It's access.
Well, you know what another major issue is? And I'm embarrassed. When I did the debate with Tanisha Sullivan, who's challenging Bill Galvin, the incumbent, a month or so ago, I asked, and I don't remember what their answers were, the notion that we're having an election the day after Labor Day.
It's terrible.
In defense of the voters or non-voters, you could not create a worse time to ask people to participate in democracy. I'm not defending their non-voting. But that's got to be fixed, too.
You know, Lee Pelton, speaking of young people not voting, there was this piece in the Washington Post saying the college students are voting now at record rates. So what do we think is up with that?
Oh, because there's been an enormous effort on colleges and universities across the nation, here in this state, I know, to encourage young people to go out and vote. That's one thing. And I think also there are a number of, ballot issues and candidates and topics that are of great interest to young people today in a way that they might not have been 10
years ago. Did you do that when you were, by the way, for those who don't know, his prior job, he was president of Emerson, where my kid graduated, and where, of course, Jared Bowen got an award. We have to mention that every single time. Did you do anything when you were president of Emerson?
Absolutely.
What'd you do?
Oh, absolutely. Well, a lot of voter education, a lot of meetings and going around to clubs and encouraging folks to vote, not the administrators, because that would not ever work, but other students who were doing
great.
That. Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
We're talking to Lee Pelton. One of the great projects you're working on, we've talked off and on about the horrible state of what I guess are called care workers. Mm-hmm. It's beyond horrible. Give us a brief executive summary of the work you guys did.
Well, we released a report on Thursday through Boston Indicators under the great leadership of Luke Schuster and Annie Califf. And I also,
Boston Indicators is fabulous, and it's a fabulous, fabulous contribution to this community.
So we issue these reports routinely, and the one that we issued on Thursday was around what we called care work, which includes people who work in the following ways: early child education, mm-hmm. And also with long-term facilities kind of work for elderly folks, the kinds of care that people need. And so the demographics are pretty startling. Some of it's predictable. Most of the care workers in this state are women, not men, overwhelmingly so. Of that group, many are immigrants and women of color. Women of color, and they're overrepresented in this field. So, for instance, whereas black workers make up only 7% of the workforce in Massachusetts. 82% of the workers, 82% of these workers are in the care workers. You see similar numbers for Latina workers and so on. The conditions under which they work are not something that most of us would want to do or could do.
It's really hard.
These are very stressful jobs. Mm-hmm. And you'll recall during the pandemic, these folks were called essential workers. They had to be there, but we didn't treat them as if they were essential in terms of pay. You look at the pay of the hourly wages for care workers, it's about half of what the median hourly wages are.
It's essentially the minimum. It's virtually the minimum wage.
Barely. In fact, it's not quite that yet.
I thought about, also during the pandemic, remember that a lot of the spread of the pandemic was because people who were working in nursing homes as caregivers or assisted living facilities were having to work multiple jobs because they couldn't make enough money in the place where they were working full time. And I'm also reminded, not just that I think it's people of color, the racism there, but also, you know, when I was a kid, teachers got nothing because 90% of teachers were women. So until they organized, until they got more men, until their unions got more powerful, they were really treated horribly. So what's the solution here? I mean, who wants to be – I was just saying to you before we went on the air, I'm a little nervous about getting old here, you know, if I have some poor person that's working 70 hours a week and getting no money.
Yeah, you'll be in good care. But I think that, what we know and what we said, it's a very stressful job, pays very little. You're not likely to have health care from your employer. Your retirement benefits are non-existent. And so it's very stressful. And a lot of the women who work these jobs working not just one job, but two jobs, and sometimes three. And they have their own children and their own family to attend to. And so they are really invisible to us. And so part of what the Boston Indicators wanted to do was to make the invisible visible to the general public so they could see the conditions under which many of these workers lived and labored.
So you know, who
can are I, these? Can I, before you do this, what? Just a couple of things here. Is part of the report, what it mentions is not only how shabbily these people are treated, but that the demand is going up exponentially as the population gets older and older. Correct. That's number one. Number two, this is like our McDonald's discussion of years ago. Remember we talked about how we are subsidizing one of the largest corporations in the world because they don't provide benefits to their people.
People qualified for,
listen
for
to this,
food stamps.
This summary of the estimated, pardon me, these workers are more likely to be on Medicaid than to access health insurance through their employers. Their employers are essentially depending on the taxpayer to do what employers should be doing. So where is the state? I mean, it seems to me, to quote and paraphrase and butcher Hubert Humphrey, we judge people by how we treat them at the beginning of life and at the end of life. And that's what these people are, child care workers, home care workers, help for seniors in need. Is the state coming to the plate? I know they had some major initiative on child care. I don't know what happened to it.
You know, the issue is what do we value?
Exactly.
But what do we value? And we don't value women.
Right.
In this environment. And we don't value immigrants and women of color, especially with respect to this work. And so, we're going to have to do something to, first of all, tell the truth, which is what this will do, but also to change our values and look deeply at what our values are. In the meantime, we need to raise the pay scale for these workers. We need to provide them with medical benefits. We need to provide them with retirement benefits and so on. And these are things that the state can do. States can, this state, any state, can help subsidize.
You know what I don't understand about this? Who are these employers? You know, I mean, I know about daycares more than I know about nursing homes where people get older, but you always, you know, anecdotally read about people that ran nursing homes that make millions and millions of dollars. You all know that the cost of nursing care facilities is through the roof, unavailable to most people. So, and yet they pay, you're paying astronomical amounts to go to these nursing homes until you run out of money, and then you're on Medicaid, your Medicare or Medicaid yourself. I guess you'd be on Medicaid at that point. And they're paying the workers very little money. So what's going on? There's a, something isn't connecting there.
Well, again, it's you know what we value and what we allow to happen in this state and other states. There's another classification of workers. These are home care workers who go into homes independently. Some of these folks work independently, and others work for agencies. And again, the same issues obtain there in terms of very low wages, long hours, stressful work, and so on.
You know, one of the things, you talked about public education on this thing, and my attitude is the more transparency, the more knowledge people have about everything, the better our democracy is and the kinder it is. But in all candor, often I think no matter how much public education you do, people are so locked in, they won't give a damn. This is an exception to me. When you see that the person who's taking care of your child, the most important person in your life, your elderly parent who you can't afford to take care of because you don't make enough and you have four jobs or whatever, if there was a good public relations campaign, and you guys could really nail it, you with some of your colleagues, it seems to me average people would get involved in an effort to make sure the legislatures and private employers, who some of whom can afford to do better, not all by their workers, as Marjorie was suggesting, do it. So I hope there is some sort of campaign, powerful and high profile, that follows this report that your Boston Indicators folks did.
Well, there will be. I mean, we, as I said, this is to shed a light on this and to begin a conversation like the one that we're having right here, so that people understand what the real issues are here.
You know, we have candidates coming up in a second, so we're practically out of time. But you know what we'd love to talk to you about next time, considering multiple hats you wear? We talked a lot about the student loan forgiveness program that obviously was implemented by Joe Biden. A lot of people think it's not enough. A lot of people plan to sue and think it's too much. And you, as not only the head of the foundation, but as a former college president, are particularly the right person to talk to. A number of people, I thought very wisely, have said, while this was necessary, whether it's enough or not is, again, what we'll talk to you about next month, it fails to address the underlying problem, which is the unaffordability of college education for the vast majority of people in this country. And it almost gives a pass. Again, while I support it, it almost gives a pass to those universities continue to charge almost usurious rates. And we'd love to explore that.
So I'm going to say something that's going to sound offensive, but it's not meant to be. you know, the discount rate, that is to say the difference between, because we're talking about cost and price, they're two different things. What's the price and what does it actually cost you? And the difference between price and cost, at least at four-year private colleges, is 50 cents, 50%. So that when you come to Emerson College and the student gives me a dollar, I shouldn't say Emerson because we're the exception, but to some other colleges and universities, the president gives that person back 50% on average. That's 50%. So there is that discount there. And are prices still hot, too hot? Yes, they are. But we also have to understand that colleges, you know, that the scholarship budget accounts for an enormous fraction of their operating budget.
You're right. I am offended.
Okay.
No, I'm not. I'm kidding.
But listen, I just want to say this one other thing. States have turned their back.
I agree.
On public colleges.
Yeah, they used to fund a lot more, right?
They used to fund a lot more. Yeah. You know, you go to University of Michigan, 13% of, you know, the scholarship budget is from the state.
It didn't used to
That's
be
like
way up high, no, like 60-70%.
We have
at least 50%.
We're going to continue this next
anyway,
month.
Yeah, I'm happy to have this.
But let's start off next month. Lee Pelton, it's great to see you as always. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much for being here, Lee Pelton. We've been speaking with Lee Pelton. He's the president of the Boston Foundation. Coming up, we're going to hear from more candidates for statewide office today. We're going to hear from Kim Driscoll up next. She's one of three candidates on the Democratic ticket running for lieutenant governor. She's next. Listen to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming online at youtube.com/GBH News. If you've been listening, you know that Marjorie and I are continuing today a tradition we have embraced for our almost 25 years on the air, inviting every single statewide candidate in a contested race to make their final pitch to the voters on either Election Day or primary Election Day. Every one of the candidates in the contested races has agreed to be here today. Next few minutes, we'll hear from the three Democrats running for lieutenant governor. First up, Mayor of Salem, Kim Driscoll. Mayor Driscoll, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us, Mayor. So tell us, first off, what are you doing today? Where are you going? Where are you going to be tonight for your victory party if you do prevail?
Yeah, major DOCD effort. Been in Worcester, Cambridge, heading to Dorchester, in Quincy right now, trying to get to as many places as we can. And tonight we'll be in Salem, right downtown, celebrating my vote, working hard after a long campaign day.
You know, do you find it weird running for an office, Mayor Driscoll, where the agenda for your job, should you be elected, is set by somebody other than you? As we discussed during the debate, there are very few constitutional responsibilities other than sitting in for the governor if he or she is unavailable and presiding over the governor's council in certain circumstances. Is that an odd thing or no?
I don't find it odd. You know, Jim, as someone who's mayor, I know that, like, leadership is not a solo sport. You rely on a strong team around you. And having people who are experienced who bring an opportunity to influence and help implement an agenda is really, really critical.
So give us why people should vote for you, Kim Driscoll, instead of your two opponents, Eric Lesser and Tammy Gouveia.
You know, Marjorie, I think we're heading into some choppy waters, and experience is really something that's going to matter as we take the reins of office in January. Whoever is lucky enough to be elected, issues of the housing challenges we have, the child care gap, the transportation woes, we're going to own that. And I know as mayor, you know, there's no hiding in a job like this. You've got to deliver services. You've got to work to impact the quality of life in the places people live. And I think it's a great experience to bring to bear to work with our next governor in a way that's going to take on these challenges.
What do you think, in recent times, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm missing one, the primary function that's been given to the lieutenant governor by whoever the governor was, Republican or Democrat, is essentially be the liaison, the contact point between the state administration, the governor's office, and cities and towns, assuming that if Maura Healey happens to be elected governor, that that's the same situation down the line. What else would you like to be part of your portfolio, Kim Driscoll?
Yeah, I don't want to diminish the role of working with cities and towns. You know, cities are very much the microcosm of the challenges that we face at the state level, and we're not going to be able to solve the housing crisis or transportation or the climate work we need to without action at the local level combined with state assistance. So for me, I would say the top issues I'm hearing about everywhere and one I'd like to lean into is housing. We don't have enough of it. We certainly don't have enough affordable housing that meets community needs. And I think that's a challenge everywhere in every community, even in places where housing is more affordable. It's not more affordable to the people living there.
How do you see yourself alike and different from Maura Healey, who is the Democratic candidate for governor?
Well, some of the likenesses, like we both played college hoops. We know what it means to be
Hold on. I didn't know that, Mayor Kim Driscoll.
Were you any good?
You played college hoop? Where'd you play? And what was your position?
I played at Salem State. I was a point guard, and we had some pretty competitive teams.
Wow. Good for you.
But go ahead. We're very superficial. We focus on things like that.
Can you twirl the basketball on your finger like Maura Healey can? Have you been practicing that?
Yeah, you know, if you're a baller, like I'm a gym rat. I grew up really, you know, basketball was my first love. And so played a lot of it and always had a pair of high tops in the back of my car just in case I ran into a good pickup game. So I'm looking forward to being her teammate in this work and advancing in a spirit agenda. Like, there's nothing better than winning on a team sport, and I'm looking forward to doing some of that if I'm fortunate enough to be elected.
Kim Driscoll, we wish you a lot of luck. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Audrey. Talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was Kim Driscoll. She is the mayor of Salem, and she's going to be running. She is running for lieutenant governor of the Democratic ticket. We're going to be talking with Eric Lesser and Tammy Gavay in just a few minutes. But meanwhile, we have some time. If people want to call in and text us at 877-301-8970 and tell us if anybody showed up at their polling place this morning, if they're all by themselves there, how bad the rain was, if anybody had a line. No.
Come on. I don't want to hear from people just who vote. I want to hear from the 70%+
okay.
who say it isn't important enough to bother okay. to vote today.
Let's hear from the deadbeats.
The deadbeats, exactly.
We
want to hear
home.
From the deadbeats. We have a special deadbeat hotline, 877-301-8970. We're going to take calls, and we'll look at the text, too, in and around the other two lieutenant governor candidates who are going to join us, as Marjorie said, Eric Lesser and Tammy Gouveia, in a couple of seconds. Do you know anybody who's not voting?
I don't know anybody who's at least admitted to me that they're not voting.
And
I know some people that say they're going to vote and then they don't show up because something happens.
Well, like
but that's
why?
Pretty bad.
Like,
I don't know. The kid gets sick at school or something
yeah,
like
allegedly.
That.
Allegedly. In any case, we're going to talk to you in a couple of minutes about your pathetic excuses for not voting. But first, we're joined.
Somebody said a little while ago that they get up off the couch because of us.
Maggie
the pickleball lady.
Maggie, yeah.
She said we inspired her. She got up off the couch and took her pickleball racket with her or whatever and went and voted.
Good for her, and we hope there are a lot more like you. Joining us now is another candidate for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side, State Senator Eric Lesser. Senator, it's good to talk to you.
Hey, how are you? Happy Election Day.
Yes,
you.
Thank you very much for joining us. So we're asking you, like we're asking everybody, Eric Lesser, what's your strategy for today? Where are you going? What are you doing? And where are you going to end up tonight should you have a victory party to celebrate?
Well, I'm soaking wet because we've been out at the polls and just trying to say hi to as many people as we can. And a big day. Started off the morning in Longmeadow voting with my family, which really meant a lot. At the moment, I'm at the East Hampton Diner. But we're going to be moving all around the state right until 8 o'clock.
By the way, the reason Senator Lesser mentioned the places he's been, because when I introduced him at the debate a couple of weeks ago, I had his wrong district. So it was
good. That's good.
And I have to say he was very kind by not humiliating me. So, you know, let me ask you also the same thing we just asked for Mayor Driscoll. You've been your own boss. I know the voters are the boss, but you're a state senator. You're the leader in the legislature along with state reps in that district. Here, I know people don't like that term, but the lieutenant governor essentially works for the governor of the Commonwealth. How is that transition from you, knowing you were an autonomous player, to one where you basically take the assignments that your, quote, boss, for lack of a better expression, gives you?
Well, it's a good question, and I think my set of experiences actually makes me uniquely suited to this.
How so?
First, I worked in an executive team when I worked in the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. You're used to kind of taking direction and working towards what the team needs. And also in the Senate, Jim, as you know, you really can't get anything done unless you've got mm-hmm. 20 other colleagues who are lined up with you. And then, of course, you need 81 in the House, and you need even more than that if the governor is in disagreement. So my job is really all about coordination and conciliation and working towards consensus. And I think that's a natural role for a lieutenant governor to help play on behalf of the governor. I also think I bring just a set of unique perspectives to the ticket that are going to be important both in November and governing after that. I'm the only candidate for Western Mass. Historically, our governors have worked with lieutenant governors from other parts of the state where they're from. Think about our current governor, Charlie Baker, with Karen Pleo from mm-hmm. Shrewsbury, Deval Patrick and Tim Murray from Worcester. Even think about Bill Weld, Paul Salucci from Hudson,
right.
Paul Salucci, Jane Swift from Williamstown in the Berkshires. So I think it's important to have that perspective to really speak for the whole state.
Does that mean you'd be taking a helicopter to work like the Governor Swift had to do?
No, we're going to be taking a train. We're going to be taking a train.
Yeah.
That's a big part of my platform.
Let's hope. That'd be great.
She took the helicopter home because her little baby
was the only journalist who defended
her,
to your credit.
Well, I think there's a little sexism involved there. But let me ask you, Eric Lesser, is there anything with which you disagree strongly with Kim Driscoll or Tammy Gouveia, the two women who are running against you as lieutenant governor, where you differ from them dramatically?
Well, I think it's really about a sense of perspective and what you're going to emphasize. I come from a region, you know, far away from Beacon Hill, an area of the state that frankly is used to feeling left behind and getting ignored. I think that's going to make me particularly attuned to the areas of our state, including many of our neighborhoods in Boston, that are not getting the focus and the attention that they need from state government. I also think the fact that I do have federal experience is distinguishing, because we're going to have some significant work to do with the federal government around the MBTA, around putting the Biden infrastructure funds to use, and I'm also the only candidate with high-level legislative experience, having worked on multiple conference committees, the extension of Deval Patrick's Life Sciences Initiative, several economic development bills. So, you know, it's a great slate of candidates. Everybody has a lot to offer. I think I've got a set of characteristics and background that's unique.
Senator Lesser, we really wish you luck, and we really appreciate your time when we know what is a very busy day. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. No, I'm in my car for the first dry moment of the day.
Yeah.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, I think you better put the heat on so you can dry up those clothes. Thank you very much, Eric Lesser.
Good luck, Senator. Good luck. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Now our final of three Democrats running for Lieutenant Governor, State Rep Tammy Govea. Representative, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you both for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us, Tammy Govea. So tell us what you're up to today. What's your strategy? Where you're going to be?
Yeah, we've been starting in my hometown city of Lowell, Massachusetts. Greeted voters there, had firefighters standing out with us, and then just been making a big loop. We're in Framingham now and then heading to Worcester, but we also made stops in Lawrence, Cambridge, and Somerville.
You know, Representative, let me approach the same topic I did with your two fellow contestants for the position. You're used to being the boss. You're the state rep representing your district. You're beholden to no one but the voters. The lieutenant governor is basically works at the pleasure of the person who is independently elected as governor. Does that kind of transition, that sort of lack of loss of autonomy, does that concern you at all?
It doesn't. And as I said in our interview with you or the debate that we had, I really do have a vision for the position, really bringing my skill set to bear as a doctor of public health, a policymaker, and a social worker for 25 years, but also my lived experience. You know, families are really struggling out there. And I've been hearing about this for the last 15 months, crisscrossing the state that I've been in this race. People are really worried. They're worried about their children's future education and whether or not we'll have a sustainable planet. They're worried about accessing housing, whether it's they're starting out as a young family or they're a senior couple that wants to downsize. I will take my lived experience growing up in the city of Lowell, and as a single mom who has struggled myself to make ends meet, I'll bring that perspective to the corner office. I think that's the perfect complement for the skill set that Maura Healey brings to the role as governor.
So, Tammy Govea, you touched on it, talking about being a social worker for all those years, being a single mom and having to worry about your bills constantly. But what else can you tell voters that should make them vote for you instead of for Kim Driscoll or Eric Lesser?
Yeah, again, I do have a vision for the position. I have a doctorate in public health. That gives me the skill set to get to the root causes of the big issues that we're facing. And then my work as a social worker, I can lean into the work that I've done as a collaborative leader, as a facilitative leader, to bring people in to help us get to the root causes of the housing crisis, the mental health crisis, the human services workforce crisis, the child care crisis, and the climate crisis that we're facing. We have big problems going on. We need someone in the corner office who can be a partner to our municipal leaders by working to solve those big issues that are saddling our municipal leaders without losing the eye on what we need as for the state as a whole. So that's what I would say to voters. I've been the executive founder of the Massachusetts chapter of the Women's March, as well as the Lowell Roundtable on Substance Abuse Prevention. So I'll also bring that skill set to the corner office as a lieutenant governor and as a partner to Governor Healey.
You know, before you leave, you mentioned a couple times being a social worker. Right before you, we spoke to Lee Pelton, the head of the Boston Foundation. Their Boston Indicators, you probably saw this last week, just a report on care workers, child care workers, home care workers, not all of whom are social workers, but many of whom have a similar bent to you. they are colossally undervalued, colossally mm-hmm. overly, huge percentage are women, huge percentage people of color. How do you change people's appreciation of that kind of work, social work, caring work? How do you change that in 30 seconds?
We have to lead on it in the corner office. That is why this will be the first working group that I get going on, is addressing the workforce shortage issues, the issues with the workforce not feeling respected because it hasn't been respected and we haven't invested in it. That's the first work that I will tackle when it comes to mental health and human services and child care. Those are the big issues that I want to get to and can get to, unlike my other opponents in this race. I can get to work on these issues on day one.
State Representative, we really appreciate your calling in on a busy day. Good luck tonight and hope to see you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Get out there and vote. Take care.
Get out there and vote. Exactly.
Thank you very much, Tammy Gouveia. So speaking of getting out and vote, we want to hear about if you've gotten out and vote, or Jim wants to hear from the deadbeats who have not gotten out and vote. You can tell us if you're not voting, why you're not. If you did vote, where you're voting. You can even tell us who you voted for. The number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. We have how many minutes until?
We have about 15 until John King is with us.
And
by the way, we're going to talk to the two Democrats for Secretary of State.
Yep.
And Andrea Campbell, who's the remaining candidate for Attorney General at the end of the show after John King. Earlier, about a week or so ago, the Secretary of State, Galvin, said 23% turnout. He's upped it a little. If anybody has any perspective on why such an abysmal number, even if it creeps up to 27 or 28, is what we end up with in a place like Massachusetts, I'd love to hear. 877-301-8970. And again, I'd love to hear from the deadbeats, the 70-plus percent who've decided they're too busy or too disinterested or too something of registered voters who are deciding today is not their day to bother to go to the polls. 877-301-8970.
Judy from Danvers says she's watching us from the couch. Oh, I didn't say that. We're streaming, right?
Yes,
Jim?
We are.
Where are we streaming? Do you know?
YouTube.com.
Someplace.
YouTube.com/GVH News.
Thank you.
That's someplace.
Yes, that's someplace. And Judy in Danvers said she had knee replacement surgery just last week. However, her ballot went into the town hall on Friday.
Good for her.
She is not a deadbeat. And Elise in New Bedford said, we hear a lot about how Oregon is vote by mail, but it's equally important that they mail voter information packets and include descriptions of the various elected positions and candidate profiles provided by candidates. I think this would go a long way towards increasing engagement in down ballot races. Doesn't the Secretary of State hand out that voter thing?
That's for the ballot questions, that red book that goes
out
to describe.
So only for the ballot questions.
I don't believe it's about individual candidates. Well, it's a pretty tough job to fairly characterize what the positions are unless you just print statements from the candidates. Let's take some calls, though. Again, we're looking for deadbeats, but we'll take anybody. Alex in New Bedford, are you a deadbeat, yes or no?
I am not a deadbeat.
Good.
I'm expected to vote for Paul Heroux for sheriff in Brooklyn County. I think he's got the best chance of beating Hodgson.
Yeah, Sheriff Hodgson. It's been tough on immigration.
I think he's a great candidate and has a good chance.
Why do you, you know, one of the things, we talked to the head of the ACLU of Massachusetts before, Cal Rose, they have a campaign, What a Difference a Sheriff Makes. Most people don't even know sheriffs are elected. What drew you to this race?
What drew me to the race was the fact that Hodgson has 25 years in office, tons of controversies, including running an ICE detention center that got shut down by the Biden administration mm-hmm. for cruel treatment for detainees, and I really feel like there just needs to be a change. If Hodgson gets reelected, it's a six-year sheriff term, and so he'll be there for over 30 years.
Hey, Alex, you make a compelling case. Thank you for calling. Did you know sheriffs were elected for 6 years? I am mortified that I did not know that, assuming Alex is right, and I'm guessing she is.
I did not know that. I think the ACLU and Carol Rose is absolutely right. We don't know a lot about sheriffs. We don't know a lot about, we do know more now, but about district attorneys and how crucial they are and who gets charged, how much they get charged, what the sentences are, all those kinds of things. Margaret from Boston, thank you for calling. Are you a deadbeat?
Well, Jim would say I am,
but
I am a super voter in every election, except for I don't vote in the primaries.
Why?
Because I am not a member of either party. and that's about party politics.
No, wait a second. Wait. Margaret, if I may, for those who don't know, there are more people like you who are unenrolled voters in this state than there are Democrats and Republicans combined, I believe, in Massachusetts. But I assume, I mean, let me just pick an example. We had Jeff Diehl and Chris Doty on at the top of the show. One of them is going to win tonight. One of them could beat Maura Healey. You don't care whether, if there's a Republican governor, whether it's Chris Doty or Jeff Diehl, that doesn't matter to you, or pick any race you want. You don't care if it's Andrea Campbell or Shannon Liss Reardon for Attorney General, really?
On a rare occasion, I might, but I'm not going to vote in a Republican or Democratic primary because it's party politics, and I stay out of it.
We hear you. I don't agree with you, but I respect you for calling in, Margaret.
Yeah, you can go back to being an independent, right?
No, but I don't think she means the technical things. I think she means it's four-party members is what Margaret is contending. So that's what her position. I don't agree with it, but she was courageous enough to call. Let's go to 877-301-8970 is our number.
We're getting candidates. A report from the Natick Precinct 3, only 354 voters.
What does that mean, only? I have no idea what that means.
Well, not many is the person's perspective by saying only.
Oh, only. Sorry.
Yes. And in Sturbridge, someone just texted to say they were the 85th person to vote in Sturbridge. I don't think that's
right. I don't know what that means. I mean, everything is comparative.
Ben says we need to have a day off from work to vote. And I agree with him. We should have a day off from work. He says he's not a deadbeat, but he can't make it. And we should stop calling people that who can't get to the polls.
Who said that?
That's Ben from Chicopee.
What did he say?
He said we need to give people the day off from work to vote.
And not call them deadbeats?
That's right.
Is Ben a deadbeat?
Well, the polls open, 8 o'clock?
Seven o'clock. Seven
to
eight
stay
tonight.
Up until 8.
Yeah.
That seems like you could somehow get there, seems to me.
Well, at least right now, unless your boss is kind enough to be voluntarily giving you time off to do it. Let's go to Waltham, where Emily's on the phone. Emily, you're in Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
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 So I voted today.
Yep.
And the only reason I knew that there was a primary today is that I got an email from my son's school saying that that drop-off would be in the gym. Oh, and there's also voting there today.
Wow, they didn't have signs all
what
around
college?
Waltham?
What school? Brandeis? What school?
Northeast Elementary.
And Emily,
from their K through 12 school. Great, that's great.
But they
Emily.
Didn't have signs in the schools saying that. I mean, all over the streets. I mean, I've seen a lot of signs.
Well, she didn't know. Whatever.
I knew that the primaries were coming up. I did not know the exact day of it. I hadn't seen it on any of my town Facebook groups.
Emily, what do you think of Margaret, who called before you? By the way, I admire Margaret for calling in and making her case. What do you think about her saying, I'm unenrolled, primaries are for party members, I'm not a member of either party, so even though I legally am entitled to vote in either primary if I chose, I choose not to. What do you think of that argument?
I mean, I vote every chance I can get.
Okay, fair enough. So, Emily, we're glad to hear it. Thanks
for
the call.
You know, here's Will from Plymouth who says he's not voting because I don't know anything about anyone. I'm not willing to vote for I don't know if he means random.
Well, whose fault is that?
Well, you
do
know something,
work.
Though? Yeah, but you know something? You can go, to the Globe. The Globe has editorials for local people and governor and statewide offices. But, you know, this is another thing about the loss of these little local papers. I mean, that paper in Wellesley would talk about their local candidates for selectman or town council, whatever they have. The same thing in Brookline. Those are gone now. I think a lot of people do not follow local politics. They'll look at an editorial in their local paper and get an idea whether they like that local paper or not, what people stand for. I think that's a big loss.
Well, yeah, maybe you're right about that. But there was some guy, I can't remember his name, but he's good on television, who did debates. Four debates with candidates in the primaries. And by the way, they're available online at gbhnews.org.
Had tuned into Jim Browdy, star of stage and screen.
Thank you.
and multimedia.
Now, by the way, if you miss the debates live, are you out of luck or what, Marjorie? What can you do then if you miss them when I did them?
Well, you can go back and look at them at the GBH website.
Oh,
yes, they are
online.
But I do think, but I said this before, I had three or four friends over my vacation who would call because they don't know anything about their the statewide races, even though you can find them. But papers, local
What'd you
papers,
say about them behind their back? Dopes when they hung up?
I didn't
What'd you say to
dopes.
Them?
I said, you know, you might want to just look into the people that might matter in your
Marjorie
hometown.
Marjorie Turner, one of her kids who was there, and said, Catherine just called dope.
I mean, but you know something? You know something? I'm guilty of some of this, too. I don't know a lot about the town I live in, which is Brookline. I don't know a lot about the politics there. I'm so busy, you know, the politics here that I have to read about every day for us. Huh. I miss out on the fine-tuning of
well,
the town council
research.
in Brookline.
It's not a town
Alex,
council, by the way.
It's whatever is it? What
whatever
is it? What is it in Brookline?
The selectmen.
Selectmen. I did know that. I met one of them in the parking lot the other day, so I knew there was a
to
selectman.
To do with him?
No, we had a nice conversation.
I was going to ask who it was. She'll have no idea who it was. My former producer, by the way, is one of them, by the way. You know that.
Oh, I do
John
know that.
John Van Skoyek.
I know John Van Skoyek.
Okay,
yes,
Alex,
I do.
Alex on the road. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hey, first time, long time.
Thank you.
Yes, we were all planned to be deadbeats because we're heading home from a vacation in Maine.
Yeah.
But you've convinced us that we need to stop at town hall and vote after
Wait a
all.
Second, is that true or is that BS? Is that really true?
No, that's deadly on this. We were going to be deadbeats, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I think Maura Healey's got this. Between the three candidates for lieutenant governor, you know, I have one that I like a little bit better than the others. But if I'm in the Democratic primary, I kind of sympathize with the caller before who's like, with the primaries, you only have this straight line. If there was something I could do to, like, you know, stop Deal from having any kind of chance, well, that's one thing. But that doesn't really exist for me. So,
okay, so Alex,
you know,
Alex,
I'll wait for that general election.
Okay, so you were going to be a deadbeat. You listened to the show. You decided to vote. Here's the moment of truth. Who convinced you to vote, Marjorie or me?
Oh, it was definitely Marjorie.
Okay, of course. Thank you very much. That's what I was hoping, Alex.
Thanks
call
for being
anytime,
an honest
Alex.
Caller.
That was a brilliant call. The most brilliant we've had all day long. Absolutely no question about it. Okay, we're going to not going to talk to any more deadbeats or non-deadbeats because we're going to talk up next to CNN's John King. He's going to join us. We're going to talk about the election, the Trump special master, and a bunch of other things. John King from CNN is next. You're listening to 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and every Friday from the Boston Public Library. And we're also streaming, Jim. Where are we streaming?
YouTube.com/GBHNews.
That is correct.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan live at the Boston Public Library. Streaming online at youtube.com/GBHNews. Two programming notes quickly. One, you just heard Ken Burns, Lynn Novak, and their colleague will be at the BSO, I think, next week sometime. Ken Burns will join us next Monday to discuss his new six-hour documentary on the Holocaust. And number two, after we speak to John King from CNN in a minute, we will talk to our final three candidates, the two candidates running for Secretary of State, Tanisha Sullivan, and the incumbent Bill Galvin, as well as Andrea Campbell, the other candidate. We spoke to Chenelis Reardon for Democratic nominee for Attorney General. First joining us, running for nothing, as far as I know, on Zoom is CNN's John King, chief national correspondent, host of Inside Politics, weekdays at noon. Hello there, John King.
I'm running for the bus, Jim.
But I'm bummed. Thank you.
I was up there a couple weeks ago, and I was trying to go to Fenway, and I was trying to go to the Green Line, and it was closed, so I had to run for the bus, literally. Get the shuttle bus.
Yeah.
Yes,
you know,
it was.
The first time I saw those shuttle buses, they had like Yankee signs on the thing, and I thought for a minute that they were bringing the Yankees fans to the Fenway. Then I finally figured out they were T-buses, right? They're
Yankee
nicer.
Bus line.
Yeah, so they're nice buses. They look very nice from the outside.
It was a nice bus, yes.
Very nice bus. So anyway, John King, this Florida judge, federal judge Eileen Cannon, has granted former president's request, President Trump, that would be former President Trump, for this special master. She's gotten trashed a lot over this, and some people thought it was crazy that we were ever going to have a special master. But what do you think this means in terms of the investigation into these classified documents winding up at Mar-a-Lago?
Well, I think we know that it adds some delay. The question is how much and how long. and how significant. And part of that is, does the Justice Department decide to appeal? They could appeal this to the 11th Circuit. It's a very conservative circuit. So if the Justice Department appeals, what are you doing? You're adding probably months, right, to the uncertainty here. So if the Justice Department decides to eat its peas, those are my words, and say, okay, we disagree with this decision, but let's move as quickly as we can. Let's find a special master. Let's get this review done. We don't, you know, we think in the end we're going to get what we want anyway because we did everything right. How quickly can you do that? So Friday is now the big day for this one. The judge has told both the Trump lawyers and the Justice Department, hopefully, to come together and make recommendations. We think any of these two or three people would be a special master. Here's how we would like the process to work. If they cannot come together, sometimes warring, you know, these are two very diametrically opposed warring parties in this case, but sometimes they can come, lawyers do come together on process. If they cannot come together, she's asked them to each make your own separate recommendations, and then we'll go from there. So that's the key test. A, does the Justice Department appeal? They have not said they will do that. And if they don't, how quickly can they get agreement? You have to be a pretty special person with pretty high security clearance to be the special master. So the potential universe of people is pretty small. And then how quickly can you move that process forward? So I think we have to go through at least through Friday and probably another week or two of trying to sort out just how this is going to work and how long it will delay things. Now, can the Justice Department move forward on some of its investigation? Yes. But if you want to call a witness before a grand jury, you like to waive the document and say, tell me about this. If you want to ask, are you the guy who carried those documents from the White House to the van, to the helicopter, to Mar-a-Lago? You want to have the documents. So can you do some stuff? Yes. The smart lawyers I talk to say you've got to be careful.
One of the things you can't do is you can't ask anybody, do you have any idea what happened to the 48 classified or whatever documents in the files that were empty? That is on hold. And John, I want to return to the special master thing. We had this discussion with the head of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts an hour or so ago. Something I've read far too little about is, you're right, it's obviously a small group of people who would be qualified to do this. What is stopping the judge in this case from picking a, quote, qualified fellow Federalist Society member who she knows privately is a big supporter of the former president and hasn't been public like a John Eastman or a Sidney Powell or Rudy Giuliani, and have somebody who is out of the mainstream, as at least most experts, including Republican experts, say her decision was?
I know that there are a lot of critics who say that, did this Trump appointee write a decision that channels a lot of what Donald Trump and his legal team have said about the process, at least raising questions of fairness, raising executive privilege questions that most smart lawyers say don't exist because he's not the president anymore. As someone who has to watch these things, I think we should watch how the next process plays out. If that fear you just raised turns out to be legitimate, I think at that point the Justice Department would have no choice but to appeal or to somehow try to stop the process and take it to a different venue. So I think, you know, I get the suspicions here. There is another side in the sense that Jonathan Turley, George Washington professor, who often takes conservative / Republican views on things, his view is, you know, maybe you don't like this decision, but they were going to have to quiet the investigation anyway because we're so close to the election. So why don't you just, you know, okay, it's not perfect, but try to get this done as quickly as possible. Then you come out of the chutes after the election, you can do your job. So I think we just have to watch the next couple of steps play out. I get, because of the political environment we live in and because this is a Trump appointee, the suspicions. I think we need to, you know, have a little bit more evidence to see if there's an actual bias or if this is just her interpretation of the law.
Well, can I just say one thing before we continue? As I said earlier in the day, there were a lot of Trump judges and justices who ruled against Donald Trump on his original election cases. In fact, virtually unanimously. It's just from having read, as I'm obviously you have, and I'm sure you've interviewed people about it, again, Republicans and Democrats who've been in Justice Department positions who find her position, not that she's a Trump nominee, but that her decision is so out of the mainstream, is just troubling in terms of fairness, I guess is the point I was
This is sitting right here on my desk. I've read it a few times. It's interesting, and yes, you can read. Yeah, there's a lot of what Trump's legal team says in here now. Her point is, let's be fair. Let's be extra fair. And there are people who complain about that, saying, why do you treat Donald Trump any differently? Right. There are others who say, okay, he is a former president, so he should get a little extra. You know, where's the sweet spot? I'm not smart enough to know. But this ruling raises a whole bunch of questions. And the next test is, can they come together and get a special master? And then we go from there.
Yeah, one of the last things about this that I think concerns a lot of people is we are close to the next elections, but of course then after that there's the gearing up to 2024, and if this does drag on and Donald Trump does declare his presidency, what does that mean? Can the investigation of the Mar-a-Lago documents continue simultaneously with his efforts to be reelected?
I think, you know, look, the Attorney General is in a tough spot in the sense that anything you do here is going to be put into the political pinata and you're going to be whacked about. But again, this is, you know, everyone will think this, I'm saying this about Donald Trump, but this should be about anybody. Just imagine, you know, I'm under investigation. Well, I'm running for something. I'm not just running for the bus. I'm running for governor. You know, I'm running for president. So that's a pretty slippery slope and a dangerous slope to allow. And so you have an ongoing investigation. If Trump were to declare tomorrow and then say, you can't do this to me, I'm running for president, I think it is a fact. It's not just that it's a Democratic-appointed attorney general. It is a fact the investigation long predated that announcement. Therefore, too bad, buddy. And I think that has to be the rule for anybody, you know, now and in the future, that you can't game the system like that.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, we don't know what the president's motives were, but it's possible they could be nefarious motives in terms of, you know, secrets that other people aren't supposed to know about. So that, I think, as a citizen, is a little bit scary.
Well, that investigation continues, though, doesn't it? Doesn't that part of it about whether there was some compromising of important security, isn't that allowed to
proceed? Well, I don't understand, though. Well, maybe that's right, but how can that be if you're not supposed to look at these documents?
The director of national intelligence can look at the documents. That's what the judge did rule, that the assessment, did this cause actual damage to overseas intelligence assets, to overseas operations? Did it expose potentially secrets about, you know, sensitive programs, whatever those programs might be, spying operations, weapons programs, people, human resources around the world? The DNI, the National Intelligence Director, and the intelligence community can continue that assessment. Was any harm done here? To the other point, though, can you bring cases? That we're in a little bit of a murky issue, as the Justice Department can't specifically use those documents. But to the point, remember, when the search warrant was first executed, one of the questions was, had Merrick Garland, at the Attorney General, and the FBI just run out of patience, and they just wanted the documents back, right? Was it just a document seizure and not so much a criminal investigation? But in this fight over the special master, they have filed paperwork that makes clear this is an active criminal investigation. This was not just about getting the documents back. They are investigating what they believe to be potential obstruction of justice and potential mishandling of sensitive national security documents. That part of it is not on hold, but it just, you know, parts of it are on pause because they can't do everything they want because they need the documents.
You know, John King, every time we ask you about polling, we're talking to John King from CNN. Every time we talk to you about polling, you go out of your way to say, and I'm paraphrasing, don't make too much of this. This is one day's polling. If we spoke to you, when we spoke to you a month ago, the Democrats were in horrible trouble across the board. Biden was accomplishing nothing. All of a sudden, there's an abortion decision. Biden, thanks to Manchin and Sinema, moving on an issue, obviously got at least a major climate initiative, drug pricing negotiations for Medicare. And all of a sudden, polls seem to be moved dramatically. Biden is a little more popular. The Democrats' prospects in the Senate appear to be remarkably good and better, but not good enough to keep a majority in the House. Is that where you see things today, understanding that it is just today?
Yeah, we count votes 9 weeks from tonight. That's exciting for somebody like me, and I've said this to you guys before. When I say this is exciting or this is fun, partisans get mad at me because I understand whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you have an investment in your candidate, you have an investment in your race. It's not fun to go through, you know, the final 9 weeks of nail biting. I respect that completely. As a student of politics, this is exciting for me. This is the first presidential midterm I can remember where we're 9 weeks out past Labor Day, and it is so uncertain. It is just so uncertain. I use the word drastically better in the polling. I don't know that I would use that term, but without a doubt, Jim, the climate is better for the president and his party now. If the climate is better for the president and his party now in a number of ways, in a number of important places than it was just 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago. This began with the Dobbs decision. The Dobbs decision wiping Roe off the books caused a major tumult in American politics, not just among liberal progressives, but also among moderate Republican centrists and some conservative. Look at the Kansas vote. Some conservative Republicans, too, who may actually be, you know, pro-life or may support significant restrictions on abortion rights, but don't want people in Washington, whether they're politicians or justices, telling them how to live their lives. So it has reached, it has redefined the midterm campaign year, the Dobbs decision, principally the return of Trump. And yes, the Democrats getting some things done. The president's numbers are still historically low. He's where Obama was right now in 2010. Obama lost 63 seats in the House. You can't lose 63 seats the way they draw the lines now. But here's how I look at it. Where is the trajectory going, right? 60% of Americans still think we're in a recession. That's bad for the president and his party. But if you look at consumer confidence, it's beginning to trend up. The president's approval rating, still historically low, but the trajectory is up. Every ticket goes up is a House seat. Every ticket goes up is better for Democrats in some race out there for some office. So it's a better climate now. Democrats are confident they can keep the Senate. Or should they be that confident? I think it's going to be plus or minus one or two in the Senate. It would be almost impossible to keep the House, but let's keep an open mind about everything. I think the more likely scenario, both smart Democrats and smart Republicans say this, is that the Republicans take the House, but by a much more narrow margin than we would have thought after Afghanistan or 6 months ago before the Dobbs decision. The races for governor, I know you're having your primary up there today in Massachusetts. Races for governor, races for state legislature are absolutely critical because of the Dobbs decision. As each state, some states won't do this because their policies are well established, but many states are going to have abortion debates. And so who's your governor? Would they sign or veto, you know, abortion legislation on new restrictions? And what's the margin in your state legislature? Do you have a veto-proof majorities or not? These races are fascinating, and we're in a very unpredictable environment. The biggest factor is Dobbs. Gas prices have come down 70-plus days in a row. Does that continue? Do people feel a little better about inflation, a little better about the economy? So this is really, for me, the tug of war in 9 weeks is who wins this debate? What is most important when you vote? Is it crime? Is it inflation? Then you're probably going to vote Republican. Is it tolerance? Is it abortion rights? Is it chaos? Is it democracy? Then you're probably going to vote Democrats. And there's still a tug of war over those issues are all up there, one, two, and three. The economy's still number one, followed closely by abortion in national polls. 9 weeks is a long time. Who wins that debate about what should be most important? That will decide what happens.
Well, let's talk about a few specific races for the Senate. Is it Ohio with Tim Ryan and J.D. Vance? Tim Ryan is a Democrat, Vance is a Republican. What's happening there?
That it is close tells you the climate has turned in favor of the Democrats. That doesn't mean Tim Ryan's going to win. But Ohio is a traditionally Republican state. That race in a Democratic president's first midterm election, Republicans should not be worried about Ohio. Should not be. But they are. Part of that is you have a first-time candidate who is appealing to Republicans in some ways, had the Trump endorsement in some ways, who is not communicating very well as a candidate so far. Tim Ryan is a blue-collar guy, and I think blue-collar issues matter this year. And plus, then you have the, again, close elections are decided in the suburbs, and you have, you know, think of the Republican, George H.W. Bush won the suburbs, he won the presidency. George W. Bush won the suburbs twice. He won the presidency twice, just narrowly. Remember, I know Democrats are saying Al Gore won the presidency. George Bush won. Florida was the issue. Florida was the issue because George Bush won Ohio and won Pennsylvania. He won the suburbs. Donald Trump won the suburbs against Hillary Clinton just barely in 2016, got swamped in the suburbs in 2020. That's why Joe Biden is president. The abortion decision and the return of Trump is changing the dynamic in the suburbs. The suburban voters who were going to maybe vote on crime or vote on inflation 6 months ago are now thinking, do I need to vote on abortion and vote on Trump? And so that's the tug of war. Ohio is close. Wisconsin has a Republican incumbent senator. In Ohio, Portman's retiring and Vance is the new candidate. So having a new politician helps the Democrats somewhat. He's less experienced. Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, the Republican incumbent. Mandela Barnes, the lieutenant governor. That race is close. That race should not be close. If this is a giant Republican year, that race should not be close. But it is.
You know, John, tonight on TV with me is Michael Kirk, who's the brilliant director of so many great frontline documentaries. The one that's being released tonight is Lies, Politics, and Democracy. And he traces the lies even from Donald Trump saying the Emmy vote was rigged when The Apprentice lost through Iowa and to the present.
I had forgotten that completely.
One of the things that is, so had I, one of the things that most powerful, I've seen the documentary, is how complicit, I know this is not news to you or probably anybody else, all the leading Republicans have been in Trump's continued high-profile place. The races that people are talking about most in this country, mere mortals, J.D. Vance, Trump guy, Oz in Pennsylvania, Trump guy, Herschel Walker in Georgia, Trump guy. If Donald Trump nominees are determined to be too radical for the general election come November, and he's wiped out, will there still be the same level of sycophancy amongst Republicans for the former president, whether he assuming he chooses to run again?
I think you raise a key question, and I could add to that, you know, Blake Masters in Arizona.
Of course.
Trump guy. We're talking about Senate candidates. You could go to Kerry Lake, the gubernatorial candidate in Arizona, election denier, Trump endorsed. We could move on to Nevada. We could go state by state in these critical races and find, sadly, too many of these people who still want to say that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president, that Joe Biden didn't win fair and square. Joe Biden won fair and square. He won fair and square. Donald Trump had every right. We've talked about this too many times. Every right, and he did. Challenging court, asked for recounts, asked to check things. He did all that. He had every right to do that. He lost them all. And so I think this is a test of American democracy, a test of patience. And I think it's a defining test for the Republican Party. We don't want, you know, we need competitive politics. We need a competitive Republican Party. There are people, you know, I always say we need a competitive two-party system. I'm not insulting anybody who wants a third or a fourth or a fifth party. Come into the fray. I think that's great. But we need a competitive political system. And when you have one party that sticks its head in the ground, the Grand Ostrich Party, as I call it sometimes, and will not confront a lie, that's troubling. I don't say that to take the Democrat side. I take that to take truth side. And so I think these documentaries are important. And I think you do raise a question that if these candidates are significantly, you know, lose on a significant basis, do Republicans finally reawaken to the idea of let's have the courage to stand up to this guy and his lies? I hope so, for the good of the Republican Party. I'm not here, you know, for the good of the system. But, you know, we've been every time we think that moment is upon us. We thought it was upon us on January 6th, didn't we? We see the backslide because they want power and they're afraid of offending him. So let's see what happens 9 weeks from tonight. Let's see how the votes go. And we'll have this conversation, you know, the following Tuesday, I'm sure.
Now, John King, we have to go, or otherwise you'd have time to say wait till next year. So you're going to have to wait till next week to say wait till next year. John King, it's a look
Thank
at the
you,
look
John.
On his face. John, it's great to see you.
You mean
be well.
The Red Sox are struggling.
I think that is.
Yeah. I'm out of the bullpen.
Okay.
See you, John King.
Thank you very much, John King. We've been speaking with John King. He is CNN's chief national correspondent. He hosts Inside Politics weekdays at noon. We watch it every day. Coming up, more calls from candidates running contested statewide races here in Massachusetts on primary election day. Next up, we're going to talk with the Secretary of State, Bill Galvin, who's running for re-election. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. It is primary election day. Vote. Go out and vote. We've spoken to every single candidate running in a contested statewide primary, except for three. One is the Democratic challenger for Secretary of State, Tanisha Sullivan. She'll be with us in a few minutes. The second candidate for Attorney General on the Democratic side, Andrea Campbell. We spoke to Shannon Liz Reardon earlier. But first up, the incumbent Secretary of State running for re-election, Bill Galvin. Secretary Galvin, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. So before I ask you where you're going today, what your strategy is, whether your party's going to be at the Stockyard across the street from WGBH, where I've seen you at least once or twice, Secretary, give us a sense of what the voting's like today. Is it good, well, not so good?
We're concerned about the effect of the weather. Obviously, yeah. That's a great concern of ours because it's been so torrential, and it's inconsistent throughout the state. Some places very light, other places it's really torrential. I'm hoping it does seem to be the ceiling is lifted a bit and the rain is a little less intense. I'm hoping that voters will come out. The only fortunate thing, unlike a November election, is going to be daylight till well after 7. So hopefully the voters will come out. You know, there's a lot of interest in these races. We did have a very strong participation in early by mail and early in person. the combined effect is we'll certainly have over 400,000 Democratic voters will have voted, and probably closing in on 90,000 Republican voters at least. They're still processing the vote by mails that are being returned by drop boxes, so those numbers are going to go up.
You know, during the debate I had with you and Tanisha Sullivan, we talked about what reforms have been made to voting in the state, what reforms need to be made. Should you be reelected, what's atop your list, Secretary Galvin, that you think would address what, in my estimation, even if the numbers are higher than you originally anticipated, what I still see is very poor voter turnout? What needs to be done here?
Well, the issue is not legal access. I think the one thing we should do on legal access is Election Day registration. That's that would be the highest priority. I think it has to be some degree of civic engagement, and it's, you know, it's easy to talk about that in terms of young people, and I think that's extremely important. But it's also true about older people and people who continue to say, well, I vote in November. Well, I think in a state like this, clearly, and not just because of the preponderance of Democratic enrolled members, which is diminishing, but the fact is that unfortunately both parties tend to be very small in terms of their core, and that tends to leave a lot of independents, which is now over 60% of our electorate, out because they think, well, I'll wait till November. Well, you can't wait till November if you want to set the stage properly to make the decisions you want to make. So getting people to vote in primaries, I also believe that we probably should try to move the primary to earlier in the spring with some of the logistical problems, understanding some of the logistical problems that that does present, but maybe it would engage people more. We can look at these various options, but in the end, it's the desire of the voter to go out. And, you know, in municipal elections, we see if you have a tax question on, a 2.5 override, or an education question on, people vote, but if there's not, they don't. Motivation is a hard thing to pin down.
So, Secretary Galvin, for those who have yet to vote and are going to vote this afternoon, why should they vote for you and not your opponent, Tanisha Sullivan?
Well, I think the details are very important. I think we've not only demonstrated here in Massachusetts that we're moving forward on voter rights, but unfortunately we're against the backdrop that around the country it's going in the other direction. And as important as our state elections are, obviously, what's coming up in 2024 is critically important. And I don't think we can underestimate the danger to democracy. And I'm not simply echoing what President Biden said the other night. I mean, that to some extent is political. I think an objective analysis would say that, you know, my wildest dreams.
Oops. I think we lost Secretary Galvin.
We'll find out what his wildest dreams are, hopefully, in a second as we make reconnection. Want to guess what his wildest dream is or no? I wouldn't if I were you, knowing you as I do, actually. Maybe
I don't
it's
know.
Safer to wait for the secretary.
And we do have to find
reconnect.
Out if he's going to the stockyard tonight, don't we?
No, he occasionally is there. That was
well, it's a great place.
It is a fabulous place.
Got a great fireplace in the corner. Oh, he's back.
Secretary Galvin, you were about to tell us what your wildest dreams were.
Well, my wildest dreams, I would have never believed as little as I thought about Donald Trump that he'd actually try to stage an insurrection and prevent the election from being certified. But he did. And without getting into the details of all the rest of it, I mean, we all saw what we saw. So I think confronting what we're confronting, the effort since January 6th of 21 to limit voters' rights, to prevent voters from participating, that's the challenge we're up against in 24. I have the expertise, I think, to lead a national effort on that. I'm now the senior Democratic election official in the country. I intend to do that. And by, the first way to do it is what we're demonstrating here today in Massachusetts, that vote by mail works, whether you're Democrat or Republican, that making access easier works, and that counting every vote, no matter what it is, you're probably aware we've had an issue in Barnstable because of a mechanical problem down there. I'm going to court this afternoon to make sure that the polls remain open down there to allow people, and primarily in that particular community in this election, it has probably more interest for Republicans, but it's still important. Their vote should be allowed to be happening, and it should be counted. That's what's important, and that's the challenge ahead.
Secretary Galvin, thanks so much. Good luck today. We appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who's running for re-election. We're going to talk to his opponent, Tanisha Sullivan, in a few minutes. But I think next up is Andrea Campbell.
Yes, she is. She is. Earlier today,
Attorney General.
Yep, we talked to Shannon Lewis Reardon, the other Democrat running for the nomination for Attorney General. Now joining us is Andrea Campbell. Counselor, welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. Great to talk to you, Andrea Campbell. So tell us what you're doing today, where you've been, where you're going to be tonight. What's your strategy for the election day?
Well, crisscrossing the state,
I voted this morning at my polling location and stopped in some other places in Boston, was most recently in Chelsea. I'll be in Quincy tonight, Newton later on. So just continuing to get out here in person and also via phone to remind folks to get out and vote in this critical election and that the polls close at 8 p.m.
What do you think are the most important issues confronting the Maura Healey's successor?
Well, one, I will say I'm honored to have Maura Healey's endorsement in this race. She has been campaigning with me, and what we've been stressing is that I will be a leader that builds upon her legacy but continues to fight for Massachusetts residents. Housing affordability is coming up quite a bit, tenant protection, inflation, price gouging, anything and everything related to the Supreme Court, of course, reproductive health care and access to reproductive health care. Mental health is a major issue as well. So really pushing to remind folks that this election for Attorney General is critical, can help them in their daily life. Now we need them to come out and vote today. This primary is essentially the race for the Democrats.
So what is the major difference between you and your opponent, Shanalise Reedon?
One, I'm working for it. My opponent is attempting to buy this election. She has spent close to $10 million of her own money in an effort to try to buy it. I'm working for it. Just like I have for anything else I've had in my life. As many of the residents I've been talking to know, all of my biological parents are deceased. All of my biological grandparents are deceased. My twin brother, of course, would die 10 years ago while in the custody of the Department of Correction. I'm the first in my family to go to college and the first in my family to go to law school. And I became a public servant to give back to this great state and to make sure every resident had access to the same opportunity. And so this is about public service and continuing that leadership. And I'm going to continue to work for it. I'm not going to try to buy it. And these are significant distinctions between me and my opponent.
You know, we broached the $9 million in the most recent report that she has spent on her own race. But her campaign, Andrea Campbell, is focused on the fact that, according to her, you had dark money through PACs in your mayoral race. You have other PACs, or at least a major PAC, in this race. And her contention is that's should be terribly troubling to voters. Why is she wrong?
I will say we have built a grassroots people-powered campaign. You can't control PACs. You can only control your campaign. And that's what I've been doing. So we've raised close to $1.5 million coming from residents. Close to 90%, actually over 90% of our donations come from Massachusetts residents who are investing in our campaign because we're meeting them where they are to work to earn their support. She is instead pouring in millions of dollars, now close to 10, I'm sure it's more than that, $10 million, to try to buy the election. So that is very different. I'm working to earn it. She is not. And I'll just add, many of those millions were made on the backs of workers. Several settlement cases where judges said, I'm rejecting the settlement because you'll get $25 million and your client will get $100. And so I think this is important for folks to understand. I've dedicated my life as a lawyer working in state government, represent children for free, to push for residents to have access to opportunity. And I've done it as a public servant and want to, of course, do it as the people's attorney, representing the people's law firm and accountable to the people.
Andrea Campbell, as always, we really appreciate your time. Good luck today and good luck tonight.
Thank you, and hopefully people get out and vote. Thank you.
Thank you so much,
so much
for joining us. That was Democratic Attorney General candidate, as Jim just said, Andrea Campbell.
Now, speaking of getting out and vote, part of the province of the Secretary of State's office, we just spoke to the incumbent, Bill Galvin. Joining us is his challenger, the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, Tanisha Sullivan. Tanisha, great to talk to you. Thanks for calling.
Great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Our pleasure.
So I'm asking you what I've asked.
What's that again?
I said, and good to speak with you too, Marjorie.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's right. I am here as well.
A
thank
wise
you.
Move, Tanisha Sullivan.
So Tanisha Sullivan, tell us what your strategy is today, where you've been, where you're going, where you're going to be tonight.
Well, we're very excited to be out on the road today. We started this morning in Boston, of course, where I cast my ballot. We've already been to Worcester and out to Springfield. We're now looping back around, headed into Metro West, into Framingham, and we'll be coming back into the greater Boston area to round out the evening. I think it's really important for us to continue this campaign, as we always have been, touching voters across Massachusetts, making sure that folks understand that when it comes to building a strong democracy, it is all of the Commonwealth, not just parts of it. And so we're continuing to do that and feeling really positive about the responses that we're getting out here. Obviously, it is a rainy day, but we are trying to encourage and inspire and motivate people to turn out to have their voice heard on this final day of this election season.
Tanisha Sullivan, I think I asked you the exact same question to open the debate with Bill Galvin on my show a month or so ago. You're the only candidate in a contested primary challenging a sitting constitutional officer, an incumbent, Bill Galvin. Why should he be fired and you hired?
Because this moment demands more, Jim. The fact of the matter is I am now in my 20th year of corporate legal practice. I am a civil rights leader, as you noted. I bring to this race both someone who has the technical expertise and experience of a seasoned attorney, layered with someone who has been deeply connected and rooted in our communities, really fighting to ensure that our democracy is working for all people. We need that more than ever right now in our democracy, with so many people losing faith in our government. We need a Secretary of State who is going to be proactive and engaged, waking up every day, 365 days of the year, working to increase voter participation, increase transparency in our government, and working to ensure that our economy is working for all people, especially working with and through our small business community. That is what I bring to the office. That's what I've been sharing across the Commonwealth. And that is how I hope to serve the Commonwealth of Massachusetts going forward.
What's the most important reform you champion to increase what you just described as voter participation, which at least I think I speak for Marjorie and me today, we both feel is pretty anemic?
It is very anemic. And here in Massachusetts, we should be leading the nation when it comes to voter participation and civic engagement. We have to continue to break down barriers to the ballot box with reforms like same-day registration. But we also have to acknowledge that a lot of folks are losing faith and trust in our government. And to repair that, we need a Secretary of State's office that is deeply connected to our communities, working in partnership with community-based organizations, really working to build trust in our communities so that we can then inspire and motivate people to vote. The fact of the matter is we can have voting reforms in policy, but if we do not couple that with the on-the-ground work necessary to meet people where they are, to restore their faith and belief in our democracy, we're not going to see the increases that we need to see. That's why we need change in the Secretary of State's office, someone who understands certainly the policy lane and the reforms that are needed there to break down administrative barriers, but someone who also is deeply connected to our communities, has a heart for the people, and will work tirelessly to demonstrate that our government is worth investing in and that our democracy needs each and every one of us to participate.
Tanisha Sullivan, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck tonight.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful afternoon. And please, everyone, don't let a little bit of rain keep us from having our voices heard. There's still time to get out to vote.
Thank you very much. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to the people that came down here to the Boston Public Library. You can tune in tomorrow.
And thanks to every single candidate in the contested race who called in. We really appreciate that.
Tune in tomorrow for Neil deGrasse Tyson, national security expert. I don't know if she's going to be here.
She is.
Oh, Juliet Keim. Okay, she is going to be here. Environmentalist Bill McKibben, GBH's Brian O'Donovan, and whoever wins the Republican nomination for governor, it'll either be Jeff Deal or Chris Dowdy will be with us. We want to thank our crews, Roy Matthews, Ed and Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Gia Orsino, our engineer, John Claw Parker, Jenny Bologna, and Sai Patel, Colin Cockrell, Brandon Carley, and Rob Vagnat. What are you doing on TV?
I mentioned this fabulous new documentary, Lies, Politics, and Democracy. Michael Kirk, the brains behind it. There are a lot of brains. He's the lead brain. Brilliant frontline documentary tonight about the lies of Donald Trump. It's brilliant, and people should watch me with him and it a little bit later. And then David D'Alessandro, former head of Hancock for Governor Deval Patrick, did an assessment of the T more than a decade ago. Well, T's still got problems. He's going to tell us where we are, what needs to happen. That's tonight, 7 o'clock, Greater Boston.
Sounds excellent.
Thank you.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you can tune in tomorrow. And if you haven't voted yet, get out there. It's election day. Thanks for listening.